What did you see?
That was big.
How big?
Big.
What'd it look like?
Welcome to Hawthorne. I'm Julian Slowick, and tonight it'll be our pleasure to feed you.
Please, Lord, make me the biggest star the world has ever known, so that I make it far, far away from this place. Amen.
A podcast takes a lot of work, okay? You have to organize the guests, you have to do a Google Calendar, and you build a following. It takes a long fucking time, and I've been working on it for a while.
Welcome to the Extra Credits. I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
So, Kels, we're back for another movie draft. People who follow us on Letterboxd know we like to rank things. It is always a fun exercise. Mm-hmm. And now we're starting to incorporate our list making onto our podcast. Last week, we were joined by Tim Grierson and Will Leach of the Grierson and Leach podcast to draft our favorite movies of 2022. And today, we are staying in 2022 because, honestly, I think we're all still catching up on our favorite movies from last year or just things that we missed out on. And so today we're going to be drafting our favorite horrors of 2022. And here to draft with us is a very special guest. For many cinephiles, I think this guest is one of the most important voices in the movie community. They are also a writer and director with their debut feature coming out this summer. And now they're even hosting a new podcast called Pre-Production. And for me, more personally, this person's love for movies actually inspired me when I was younger to treat my love for movies more seriously. And there are only a few people in the industry, I think, of talking about movies that have inspired this show. And one of those people is Chris Stuckman. Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Thanks.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much for having me here and for that super, super kind intro. That means a lot to me, man. Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm excited to talk about horror movies. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Let's do it. So, before we get going, Chris, I started listening to you on YouTube, I'm sure like most of our listeners, when I was younger, like 17 or 18. I think I came across your Prometheus review, followed by your Prometheus analysis that I really loved, and I just still go back and watch.
The good old
days. Yeah.
That was like before every video was an explained video. Like there weren't that many explained videos at the time, and now it's like a whole genre.
Yeah, it was one of the originals. And I remember thinking at that time, I want to buy all the stock on this guy, Chris Stuckman. And the stock has been taking off for me for a decade, but especially in this past 2 years. You are going to have a feature film out soon, Shelby Oaks, which we are both very excited for.
Yes.
And we'll definitely be covering it on this show. Mm-hmm. And your YouTube channel. Yeah, of course. And your channel has like never been bigger. And now you're bringing on other creatives on your podcast, Pre-Production, to talk about their experiences in making movies. How are you juggling all of this work and your family on top of that?
Yeah.
You must be exhausted.
It's a lot. To me, gratefully, I thrive on being busy, for one. I really enjoy being busy. I'm a bit of a workaholic. On days when I don't have anything to do, I feel sort of like I'm wandering around and I don't know what's going on. Like, I need something to do. Give me something to work with. And so, you know, the day to day, really, it's you get up, your kids are there, they're hungry, you feed them, you take care of them, play with them, you know, you try to be there for them. And I'm honestly was terrified to be a dad, like just terrified, but I'm really loving it. I just love my kids so much, and they teach me things every day. I'm also learning about filmmaking watching them, because I will sort of, they'll get like a little bit of TV time near the end of the day, maybe like 30 minutes, 40 minutes of TV time or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of noticing the things that interest them at this very young age. They can't speak yet very well. They're learning few words here and there. So dialogue doesn't really matter to them. But like visuals and storytelling through imagery really does. And they get really arrested by like long, quiet sequences that don't necessarily have dialogue. I've noticed as soon as people start talking, they're like, I don't care about this. I'm going to go look at a toy.
Yeah.
But it like kind of taught me a lot about visual storytelling, just watching them watch movies. And so, yeah, so that's, you know, it's throughout the day, you're taking care of them. And then once they go to bed, I tend to just work all night until almost sunrise. And whether it's editing or writing or watching something I'm going to cover, going on Zooms and doing podcasts like this. You know, it's like that's my time to kind of focus on work. And so it's busy, but honestly, I kind of feel very alive having things to do constantly. It kind of keeps me going.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I know you've been covering The Last of Us on YouTube recently. We've been covering that on our show.
Mm-hmm.
We just finished it because we have screeners last night. And I don't know if you have, but it is going to be quite the ending. So we're really excited for listeners to see that one.
I was surprised that they sent the last two episodes in one, because they had been doing one a week. And then all of a sudden they were like, here you go. Here's the last two. I struggled to not watch them back to back, but I didn't. It's been fun because, like, there are things I remember about the game and things I forgot about the game. And so some of those things that I forgot, I feel like I'm discovering again on the show. And then other things are happening the way they did in the game. But I really was like, don't watch them back to back. Like, let the last one sink in, take a break, do the video, and then watch episode 9, which is what I did. And I'm glad I did, because I was able to like digest it. I'm really enjoying this weekly episodic thing.
Me too.
We're getting now. You know, I think I got a little spoiled with binging and being able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. The Netflix model obviously works, but it is tiring, especially if you do what we do, which is trying to update listeners on our thoughts and having to binge Stranger Things season 7, whatever's coming up in one day.
Yeah, very. It's like, here's this giant pile of content, and then there's like 7 movies that are out that you want to talk about, and there's 2 other shows that are also running at the same time, and people want you to talk about that too. And because I really did find myself in this sort of crossroads where I realized that I wasn't enjoying entertainment as much as I did before, when I realized that it was all like sound bites. It was like digestible reviews and little sound bites that I could put out on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And the word content was kind of becoming more prevalent to me. And I really wanted to get back to where I was focusing on the films and the TV and really able to like let it sink in and experience it, instead of just like this pile of like, what are we doing today? Well, Last of Us, Stranger Things, and Marvel, and Star Wars, and DC, and all this stuff. And knowing like I can just focus on, I'm going to watch one episode of Mandalorian this week, and that's it. And I'll just enjoy it. You know, that's really nice.
Yeah. It's also nice just water cooler talk, just kind of catching up with everybody about an episode through a week. Aside from reviews on YouTube, before we get in this draft, I want to talk about your time as a writer and director, because you've been making movies for a long time, at least my experience with you. I've seen the Indiana Jones stuff. I've seen the short film from a few years ago. I've seen the kind of like background that you give and like what the pre-production process looks like, which has been really helpful for people who love film like me and like else. What is Shelby Oaks? Can you tell the listeners a little bit of like about the movie? I know a lot about it because I keep up to date with this stuff, but can you tell us a little bit more about the film, maybe some influences going into it?
Yeah, for sure. Like essentially I wanted to make films since I was 14 and like desperately. If you see any articles when this movie comes out that describe me as a film critic turned filmmaker, they're lying. I have wanted to be a filmmaker since I was a kid, and the YouTube thing kind of just came about as a surprise. I had no idea that you could make money on YouTube. I didn't know what monetization was or anything. I was just like, I'm seeing movies every week. Let's just make a video. And I did that for a long time, and eventually it kind of caught on, and I'm very grateful for that, and I'm not like talking down to that, but filmmaking was always the goal. And I guess when I turned 30, and I'm 34 now, but when I turned 30, I kind of felt like, huh, this isn't happening. It hasn't happened yet. I feel like you kind of become aware, like as a filmmaker, I think filmmakers are very aware of a clock ticking, like more so than others, because nobody starts thinking about time running out when you're 30, you know, but like filmmakers for some reason are like, oh shit, like I haven't made my first film yet. Steven Spielberg made this one.
Yeah.
You know? And so you always compare yourself to those unnecessary comparisons that don't really need to. You don't need to have that in your head. Like, I think Taika Waititi said he didn't even realize he wanted to make movies until he was in his 30s.
Yeah.
So, and then you look at actors, like Morgan Freeman has been a grandfather my whole life. Like, he's been like, he started when he was older, and that happens too. But point being is, I started to think, oh shit, I really need to to get going here. And really, really worked hard on writing a lot and just really putting a lot of effort into it. And had a lot of meetings, and I never got repped with a manager or an agent or anything, but I would kind of reach out to people and we would chat, people that I respected, ask them for feedback on scripts, and they were very kind to read my probably terrible early drafts and give me feedback and, you know, tell me like, go here, go there, try this, try that. Never got any handouts or anything, you know, but just advice, kind of like point mm-hmm. me in the right direction. And finally, I think I got a little frustrated with the fact that nothing was happening. And so I decided to write a treatment that I could self-finance. I was going to make a movie for $20,000. And that was my goal. And that became the first treatment for Shelby Oaks, was this incredibly cheap movie. Like, just, you know, I was going to make it so, so cheap with like a skeleton crew of like five people. And, you know, that is what I pitched to Paper Street Pictures, who I ran into by chance at Fantastic Fest right before the pandemic in fall of 2019. And which feels like it was when I was a baby. I don't know.
A long time ago. Yeah.
Whatever happened before the pandemic doesn't, I was a child. and I pitched that to him, Aaron B. Koontz, the producer. And he kind of flipped for it, and we developed it through the early months of 2020. And then when the shutdown happened, I thought, well, there goes that. You know, that's done now. That's not going to come back. But to my surprise, they said, no, let's keep developing it. Let's just do it over Zoom. And so through all of 2020, I just drafted the script over and over again, went through like, I don't know, 8 to 10 different drafts of the script. And before I knew it, it was getting more expensive and it was becoming something else. And that initial seed of an idea that I could make myself was becoming something that I really needed help with. So we talked about maybe we'll try to get some financing. And we were at a point in the process where we realized we could probably raise maybe a couple hundred grand. And just that would be the limit, you know. And I said, great, that's better than 20. Yeah. So script was ready. Had a great DP named Andrew Baird, who I would love to work with on every movie I ever make. He's a genius, and I had the best experience working with him. Him and I sat down and we shot-listed the script, and we looked at each other after about a week of shot-listing, and we were like, we don't have enough money to make this mm-hmm. movie the way we want to make it. And we had to really sit back and think about that. And I had never done a Kickstarter. I had never done any crowdfunding or anything like that. I was always kind of scared to be honest, because I didn't mm-hmm. want to feel like I was like asking people to give me money. And it kind of made me feel, you know, a little apprehensive. But I talked to people like Jim Cummings, who's done three of those, Thunder Road, Wolf of Snow Hollow with a beta test. And I looked at other really established filmmakers who were doing Kickstarters, like Spike Lee even did one. And I was like, okay, maybe I should just get over myself. And so, as you guys know, I did the Kickstarter and we raised $1.4 million. And all of a sudden I was like, we can really make this movie the way I want to make it now. So yeah. It came about. And that's like the bottled version of the making, like the development phase. But it's a horror film that combines different kinds of media in a way to tell a story in an unorthodox approach. And it's got a lot of influences from things from all the way from Lake Mungo, a little bit of the X-Files, a little bit of Hereditary in there. And to be honest, it's been really hard to pitch because I tried to write a movie that wasn't like something else. Mm-hmm. And that's been very difficult. In the financing stage was people would be like, well, what's it like? And then I would say, you know, Lake Mungo, and they're like, what's that? And so it's very difficult sometimes when you're trying to find money for a movie, because they all want you to say whatever the current buzzword is. So like right now, for instance, if you told somebody, I want to make a movie that's like Barbarian and Quiet Place, they're like, I know what that means.
Yeah.
But if I say, I want to make a movie that's like Lake Mungo and a little bit of one episode of the X-Files, they're like, okay. I'm not giving you anything. I don't know who you are. And an Australian mockumentary from 2008. Sure.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting experience, and that's why I'm so grateful to the people who donated to this campaign and made that part of the process so much infinitely easier for us. And I will always be so grateful for that.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't sound unlike Jordan Peele's experience with making Get Out in terms of talking about like creating original stories and how difficult that is, especially when you're doing them off your very specific sensibilities and interests as mm-hmm. a creative. So, I mean, all of that's like inspiring, especially yeah. the Kickstarter. I'm sure that must be like a lot of pressure, but also must feel like a lot of love from people. And I mean, we are included in that group of trying to support the movie. I want to tell people, go to our description of our episode where you can find Chris's Shelby Oaks website where you can support the movie and trying to go even further than where it is right now. Yeah. I think it should be coming out this summer, right? Or around that
so
time?
So we're planning on being, for those listening, we're planning on fully locking the movie this summer. And then we okay. will really aim toward, we're aiming for like early fall festivals. That's our okay. hope. And so, yeah, in regards to, you know, the link you mentioned, we're still working on VFX right now. And we've yeah. still got musical score coming up too. So, you know, we're still going to be spending some money in posts, and we're working on getting a really, really great soundtrack. So that's not going to be cheap. I've learned. There are so mm-hmm. many things, you guys, that I've learned about this, what things cost mm-hmm. that I never really realized before. You take so much for granted. The royal for granted sometimes when you watch a movie. You're like, oh, well, this just really came together. And then when you're doing it, you're like, God damn, that cost $20,000 to do that? Really? Like, yeah. Jesus. That was the original budget for the whole movie. Yeah. And so it's been a crazy ride. And but honestly, I've seen the movie now like 100 times, and I'm very proud of it. I'm very happy. Other people yeah. who I've seen it are also very happy, and I'm just excited to share it with people when it's ready.
Yeah. So me too. I mean, I'm really
yeah,
excited
we're so
to see
excited.
It. Listeners, yeah. go check that link in the description and also to Chris's YouTube channel and his podcast Pre-Production. And Chris, in pre-production, you're talking to filmmakers about their first experiences in making movies, or is it just their careers in general? Like what is the mission of that pod?
Yeah, you got it. The first experience. So like, I've always been fascinated with how people broke into the industry mm-hmm. because I think it's that one question, you know, I think any question that an aspiring filmmaker asks an established filmmaker is usually a variation of how do I do it?
Yeah.
You know, they might say like, do you have advice for a first time filmmaker? They might say, hey, you know, what's your best advice for a log line on a script? Or when do you think the inciting incident should happen in a script? They're all just asking, how do I break into the industry? So basically, I wanted to do a podcast about that, where people who have done it come on and say, this is what I did. And the idea is that it starts with their initial spark, however old they were. Maybe they were 5 years old and Indiana Jones came on TV, or maybe they were 20 years old and they took a film studies class, whatever that thing is that made them go, I think I want to do that for a living. Because that fascinates me too, because it's such an, it's like a almost arrogant thought process of like, I can make movies.
Yes.
I'm going to do that. And I want to know, like, what made you so crazy to think that, you know, like what broke in your brain that made you think I can do this? Because that happened to me. And I was, you know, incredibly naive and, you know, 14 years old. But I really want to know, like, where that started, and then take the listener from that initial spark all the way to the making and release of their first film. So what did they go through? How many did they make short films with their friends in their backyard? Did they jump into, you know, making stop motion or playing with their action figures or whatever it was to get to that point where suddenly someone took them serious and said, here's money, go make a movie, and we're going to put it in theaters or release it on a streaming network or something. So yeah, it's been really educational for me just to like talk with people about that. I've got a lot of episodes in the can already that haven't come out yet.
Nice.
And it's been fun because like for me, I think the ultimate goal is to look back, like let's say I got 50 episodes out, you know, in a couple years or something. And I can look back and try to find some kind of common denominator that everybody did. You know, because I think that's one of the biggest things is everyone kind of breaks in a different way. There's a guest I have coming on in a couple of weeks who made this really great analogy that basically Hollywood has this wall around it, mm-hmm. and there's a bunch of people all trying to break in through that wall. And occasionally somebody finds a crack in the wall and slips through, and then everyone just crowds around that crack and is like, I'm going to get in. How did you do that? Like, I'm going to copy off you. What did you do? Right. It doesn't matter because that person already found the way, and now it's closing. So, but then there's other people who just smash their way through with sledgehammers and pickaxes, and they're like, I'm going to do anything. I'm going to get in here no matter what. And so everyone has a different way of breaking in. But if I can find like one common thing that everyone universally did, even if it's as simple as they never stopped making things no matter what, whether that was on their phone or with a camcorder, or they wrote or they acted in plays or whatever it was. Whatever it is, I'm looking for that. What did everybody do that eventually led them there? So I can at least give like that nugget of information to other aspiring filmmakers like myself who are hoping to break in.
Yeah, that analogy is really apt because, I mean, the creatives we've had on the show talk about that very similar process. Like mm-hmm. Lauren Hadaway from The Novice, which is a great movie from last year, came on and talked about how she left her small town in Texas to move to like California and Hollywood and just try to work from the bottom to the top. And it was a very rare experience of that actually happening, of that actually kind of mm-hmm. her making it, versus like other ones where a script randomly hits the right hands, like Zach on Barbarian, Zach Cregger hitting Roy Lee and at the right time. And sometimes it is just timing, and people do find that those holes close up pretty quickly. So yeah, I mean, it's just incredible to hear from the insight on that podcast. So listeners, check out Pre-Production. I follow and listen every week, and it's a great show. I'm excited to hear mm-hmm. what you got in store for us. Okay.
Thank you.
Of course. Let's do this. So, rules for the draft. If listeners are not familiar with the movie draft from last week with Grierson and Leach, today we'll each be drafting 5 movies. We are doing a snake draft, which means that the picks will go in order like this. We'll go person 1, person 2, person 3, person 3 again, person 2, person 1, and then person 1 again, and so on. If listeners are not familiar with the snake draft, I think you'll just kind of get it as we go along.
Yeah, once we start going.
Yeah. So
it's
we're
like
going to put
you're watching someone play a board game and you're like, can you just do a few rounds? And
can we do a practice round? Yeah.
Exactly. So we'll put our names in a randomizer to determine who gets to draft at what spot. And the most interesting thing I think about a snake draft and why it's more fun to do it this way is that slot 1 isn't necessarily the best position to be in. Although for Kelsey on the Grierson Leach podcast, you got Tar first. For
I
best
won that
movies
draft.
Of 2020.
Yes, you with won. Tar, I think.
The voters.
The key element.
Yeah, the voters like that. And I think that there was another movie that you had that people
I had
loved.
Like Banshees of Inisherin.
That's what it was.
I had some other great ones I think that are underrated, but I think those are the ones that put me over the top.
It was a good list. Yeah. So Kelsey won that and she had the number 1 pick. So I guess I could be wrong, but Chris, after the draft, we are going to be putting our list on social for people to vote, especially on Letterboxd, where most of our following is. And I'm curious, Grierson and Leach had different styles last week, but are you playing with any strategy in mind? Are you planning on drafting with your heart, or are you playing for the people and the vote? What are you thinking?
Honestly, I just have movies that I've listed here that I know I can talk about from the perspective of liking them. And also just, I'm going to talk about movies I liked that I think other people should see. Most of them, I'm sure, have been seen, but there are a few on here. There's a couple that maybe you haven't seen. Not you, but maybe some people out there listening. I'm sure you've seen everything I'm going to mention.
Well, that is the goal. We hope listeners are finding new movies to watch.
Yeah.
Kelsey, what about you? What is your, what are you doing
Well,
here?
I drafted with my heart last time, and it just happened that people also loved what I loved. And so I think I'm going to do the same thing and I hope it will work out for me.
That's a way of saying you have really good taste.
Yeah, I have confidence going
into
this.
I went pure populism with mine. I was like, okay, I'm just going to pick what people want. No, I'm just kidding. They're all great movies. Okay, so a couple final points before we figure out our slots and then draft. We might spoil parts of movies today. So listeners, please, if you hear a movie drafted you want to know nothing about, just check our timestamps in the description to skip ahead to the next pick. That's why we put them there. So just use those. And this is a horror draft. And horror movies famously have the most subgenres. And I'm not going to lie, I've been a little scared to do this because of, of horror fans, which I am one. Obviously, Chris, you're directing a horror movie. So obviously, you're a horror fan too. But the horror community is tough because there are so many subgenres, so everybody has a different relationship to the genre. Like you have horror mysteries or psychological horrors or body horrors or slashers, whodunits.
That's what I love about it, man.
Exactly.
It's just it's an endless pit of awesomeness. But also the horror community is great, man.
Like yes.
people it's one of the most inclusive, inviting communities in film, without a doubt.
Yes, yes. I get nervous about somebody saying just that one comment. You know how it goes with comments. Like the one comment that goes, that's not a horror movie.
Right, yeah.
Listen, man, like that doesn't matter. Yeah, just have fun. You know what I mean? Like I think that movies I'm going to talk about are in the genre space of thriller, suspense, horror.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I land. You know what I mean? Like a perfect example for me is Wes Craven's Red Eye is technically not really a horror movie, but I would consider it a horror movie, even though it's a thriller. It's like horror thriller. It's got all that in there. I think it's just, does it scare you? Does it thrill you? It counts.
Right. Yeah. Agreed. I think Red Eye is a great example. Now I kind of want to rewatch Red Eye. Okay.
So good,
it's very good. Okay. I want to remind old listeners, though, and tell new listeners that we are an independent show. So be cool. 5-star ratings only. All right. Let's do this. So Randomizer. I have a random website here. I guess I should shout them out. Random.org. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you for, yeah.
Let's see here. Okay. Kelsey. You're back at number one.
Wow.
First pick. Chris, you're at number two, and I have The Turn at number three.
You have the back-to-back.
Yeah, so now I'm really thinking about what that's going to look like.
Okay.
All right, so some of these I'll say more about than others. I'll just say that at the top because many of our listeners have heard us talk about some of these movies, and so I'll be short with some of them. But others, we haven't talked about at all on the show, so I will be talking about these a lot in depth, a few of these at least. Kelsey. You're starting us off.
Okay, I'm going to go in. I'm nervous because there's two that I was thinking about, but I'm going to go ahead and start the draft with Nope.
Okay.
Jordan Peele's Nope. So I think on the surface, Jordan Peele creates an alien sci-fi thriller. And it's similar to Jaws in the Sky, people have said, and inspired by Signs and Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reason Peele is one of my favorite writer directors is that he tackles a lot of complex themes. And I said this on the Nope podcast, but it seems like an appropriate description for the horror podcast that he has this creative, surreal way of sticking his finger in open cultural wounds.
Yes.
And in Get Out, he examines systemic racism with horror, comedy, and surreal elements. In Us, he looks at the paradox of success, since we're inevitably connected or tethered, as he puts it, to someone who doesn't have opportunities. And in Nope, Peele examines spectacle, exploitation, commodifying trauma, the fallacy of the American dream.
Yeah.
We did a whole, I think two-part episode on it.
Yeah, we brought Charles Holmes from The Ringer on to do a whole trilogy and then talk about Nope in depth. Yeah, there's a lot on Nope.
So you can go back and listen to those. But I think the movie, besides its themes, just also has great characters and great tension. Every time I've rewatched it, it's been better for me. And it has those great scenes, of course, like the blood rain on the house and the people getting sucked up by Jean Jacket.
Yeah, that's lived in my mind rent-free for like 8 months now.
I was like, how did he do that? Yeah. But it also has great character development scenes, and they become better on rewatch when you're trying to look at what Peele is saying in the movie, specifically with the Haywoods and Ricky Jupe Park in the Gordy's Home Museum. And lastly, just for Peele's films, I think comedy is so important in horror and thriller movies. And he obviously just has such a handle on that with his comedy background. So, listeners, you can go back and listen to us deep dive that. But I think Nope is my top pick for the year. So it's going at my number one.
It's a great movie. It is really cool that he made a summer blockbuster that feels Spielberg, Shyamalan inspired. Mm-hmm. And Kaluuya and Palmer are so good in this movie. And the practical and visual effects are so well done that I actually think there's one big part of this movie that gets overlooked because it is such a spectacle, which is the script. The script is really great. I was really hoping for a nomination here. I know he's gotten the love for Get Out. Us was a little bit tougher received, but Nope, I think this is a really, really nuanced screenplay. And in rewatching it a lot of times now and really sitting with it there's a lot of symbolism, like there is in a lot of his films, and I think it's ambiguous enough for audiences to have a vast amount of interpretations, which makes his movies kind of special. I think the obvious ideas in Nope are what you said, like about exploitation and kind of like an ongoing cycle of oppression in Hollywood. And I love how Peele explores that kind of like commodification of trauma through Hollywood, and then using Jean Jacket in the Sky as like this metaphor for, I guess, like the allure of the American dream is like what we've talked about. So I think all of that really works. I love the way he also investigates the ideas of intersectionality and exploitation through the characters. Like when we get Ricky Jute Park, played by the incredible Steven Yeun, somebody who probably also...
I wish we got more of him in the movie.
Yes, that was the one thing about the movie. Even though it is long, I was hoping we did get more scenes from him. Steven Yeun, I think, could have also been nominated here because his performance is layered. He is playing a character who is tokenized by Hollywood, and he's kind of like left to monetize his grief, and he commodifies like his oppressed past and his traumatic experiences with Gordy. Mm-hmm. And that storyline didn't make sense for me at first, and I struggled with this movie the first time I saw it. And then seeing it again, I noticed how it helped illustrate the future of Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer's characters, who are kind of supposed to be Hollywood royalty, right? Because they had the first black jockey and the horse in the motion picture as part of their family. Mm-hmm. And they never got what was theirs and what they were due. And they were kind of cast out like Ricky was. And they eventually get their own spectacle to exploit in Jean Jacket. So I kind of love how he's able to weave all those ideas through this story. And it's just one of the most impressive movies of the year. And then there's the meta nature of the script, which is Jordan Peele making a movie about how exploiting spectacle is bad while also making a blockbuster spectacle.
Right.
So there's, I think a lot there is kind of making Nope as a psychological experiment of himself and like his own success of how he's like made money off of social issues in films and like just kind of negotiating like how to feel about that, which he's kind of been more open about.
Which he's talked about too,
in the last few months. So yeah, Nope, great number one pick. I probably wouldn't have done anything different there.
And also, I love what Hoyt Van Hoytema did with the cinematography in that movie. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you guys have probably heard about this, but like this sort of technique that they used for those nighttime sequences.
Crazy.
Filmed partially during the day, infrared cameras at night, kind of combining the layers there. And it really does create that sort of that viewpoint that the human eye has at night, which is really impossibly hard to do for nighttime cinematography, unless you're Roger Deakins and you're just a dude. Like, it really did feel, I was like, is this good day for night? Because day for night is a technique that is usually kind of looked down upon when it comes to cinematography. But what they did with that was absolutely revolutionary.
Okay, great pick. Chris, you're up at number two. What do you got?
Okay, so basically I pick my number one favorite horror movie of the year?
Yeah. Just pick whatever's at the top of your list each time.
Yeah, and then whatever someone picks you, it's off the table.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So mine is Pearl, Ty West's Pearl.
Yes.
So obviously we had X and Pearl in the same year, which is still mind-blowing to me. I remember seeing X, and I don't. It's cool because like Ty West, as a filmmaker, was getting kind of burnt out. He was getting kind of tired of the game, from what I understand anyway. Mm-hmm. I haven't talked to him personally, but people who know him have suggested to me that he was getting kind of tired of the whole thing, and he was looking into other gigs and directing other things and whatnot. But this character that he's created with Mia Goth, I guess, has really revitalized him and really kind of given him like that kick he needed to keep wanting to make stuff. And obviously, because he's got a third one coming out soon.
It's crazy. Maxine.
Mm-hmm. But also the journey of this franchise is so cool to me that you would start at the point that they did with X and then say, same year, a couple months from now, we're going to go back and we're going to showcase this older woman when she was young. Because there were things in X that intrigued me, but I didn't have the answers to. And mm-hmm. I knew, I was like, there's something here. There's got to be something else here. I saw X in theaters, so I got this little snippet of a preview for Pearl at the end of at the credits, which was like a special theatrical thing, I guess, from what I understand. And I was like, okay, so this is like a thing that he's doing. And I read that he had basically approached A24 while making X and was like, we got the sets built. Is there a way that we can just roll right into doing Pearl? And they were like, yeah, let's do it. So Pearl to me is one of the best like prequels I've ever seen. I think it's so much better than X, and I liked X, but I think Pearl is the kind of film that I just don't see it being an easy sell, because your protagonist is a psycho. Like, mm-hmm. she's just a killer. You know, she's kind of the villain, and you're with her the whole time. And he does so many amazing things with color. Like in the early, like the first shot of the barn opening, and the farm looks so beautiful. And there might as well be a rainbow or something. Like, it's
yeah, it looks
so
like the Wizard
perfect.
Of Oz contrast. Yeah,
yeah, it does. It's everything. All the colors are super saturated, and it's so. And she's, you know, dancing around with a pitchfork and singing to animals, and it just seems so wonderful because she's got this vision of what her life should be like. But then as soon as she looks at that duck, that like. Or whatever, I think it was a duck, I forget, that just ruins the moment for her and is like essentially heckling her, like quacking, you know, and you're like, yeah, that duck's going to die. as soon as that happens, though, you kind of opened up into exactly what the character is in such a brilliant way that they've established her childlike viewpoint, but the ability to kill and without remorse in one scene. And it's so, so smart to set it up that way. And also learning about her family and seeing how she was treated by her parents and the situation with her father, who, you know, couldn't move and couldn't talk really. And she had to take care of him, and her completely unrelenting mother in an amazing performance. I'm blanking on the actress's name right now. I feel bad. But such a good movie, an absolutely Oscar worthy performance. I'm blown away.
Yeah,
she wasn't nominated. I thought it was a shoo-in, but again, I felt the same way about Toni Collette in Hereditary. So I guess we're just at this weird stage where if you're an actress in a horror movie and you are phenomenal, you know, it doesn't matter. You need to make a drama. But there's like that 8-minute monologue with its unbroken take. Nuts. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And she cries like 5 separate times in this take. And you're watching it, and you know, that isn't the drops they use sometimes to create the tears. And it's not CGI tears. It's such a phenomenal performance. And as a movie that, you know, I didn't watch it and jump out of my seat or something. There's not like jump scare every 10 minutes. It's just a riveting descent into complete madness. And from that opening scene that becomes so colorful and beautiful and then descends into this, like, I'm just going to kill this animal, you have this sense throughout the whole movie that there is no way she's going to make it to the big time like she thinks she will. You just know that's not going to happen. Plus, we've seen X and we know what her future looks like. Mm-hmm. But that scene where she does the audition and the failure of the audition still hit me like a ton of bricks. And it's because of Mia Goth. And, you know, she's just an absolutely incredible talent. That's easily my favorite horror movie of the year.
Yeah, we actually just checked this out recently because we liked X, but for some reason we just didn't catch Pearl in theaters. And I have to say, I was really, really surprised because I did like X. Like, I had issues with it. I mean, I love Ty West's style. Like, I love that he's able to blend seamlessly different genres from like the horrors of the 70s mixed with like a postmodern version of horror that he is kind of, I wouldn't say creating, but adding to. And there's something rebellious about the way he shoots his films. And I just didn't feel myself necessarily connecting to the story of X, even though I respected what it was doing. And it's kind of like semi-meta narrative of commenting on the genre. And I liked its ideas. I just wish it kind of would have went with them more about like the sex positivity mixed with the religious trauma. I thought that was all very effective. But then you get to Pearl and it feels like a completely different movie, but it keeps that story beat that allows it to kind of be a really successful prequel. And I was thinking about the best prequels I've seen recently because we get a lot of them in IP. And I think you're right. Like, this is one of the best prequels I've seen in a long time. And I think a lot of that has to go to Mia Goth's performance. But I think importantly, what's the noticeable difference here is she also co-wrote the script. And I think that has a lot to do with the success of that character in that movie. Because ultimately, the movie I kept thinking about was Joker, was Todd Phillips' Joker. And I kept thinking about how it was a character study about what can happen to people with all these obstacles around them. In no ways you're trying to sympathize with Pearl, even though I think there are people on Twitter who do, and what she does and her actions. But I think it is actually a way more fascinating story and a lot of plot beats than there were in X. So I'm really excited for Maxine. I think it's going to be a really good time.
Yeah, I'm excited
too. Me too.
Yeah. Okay, that was a great two picks. I'm not going to lie, I was going to pick Nope first, so I'm a little stuck here.
And you have back-to-back.
And
here,
I have Pearl actually on my list, my long list, so I'm kind of trying to parse this out. I got two picks in a row. Okay, let's do this. So this movie is the best theater experience I've had since Avengers Infinity War. It is Barbarian.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
I love this movie, but I was thinking about, because we saw this twice in theaters, maybe three times, but I was thinking about each time throughout multiple weeks. It wasn't like opening weekend that we saw this movie. The theater had the same reaction.
Yeah, no, it was one of my most fun theater experiences too this year.
Yeah, and I think we're cheating a little bit because we had Zach Gregor on the pod and we broke down like every detail of this movie because it's like riddled with so much stuff to unpack. That's a ton of fun to talk about. I think in that conversation, we went from like the meaning of the word barbarian to like the fragility of men and like toxic masculinity to talking about Ronald Reagan and like the white flight of Detroit. And like, we got into a lot of stuff and it was a lot of fun to analyze the movie with him. But I think why I love it so much is I really miss horror comedies. And that is what Barbarian is to me at its core. It is it's somebody making a horror comedy that is probably the best horror comedy I've seen since Scream, even though Barbarian has like more emotional stakes than normal, I think. Like comedic beats in horror movies, like there is an incredible sense of humor because you can really feel like you're in the hands of a trained comedian, which Zach is, and he really knows the texture and layout of a joke so well and how similar that is to scaring people. So I love this movie, and I think there's gonna be, well, we know there's gonna be a lot of big things coming from him. Like, he just signed onto New Line, which is great for horror filmmakers like Chris and like everybody else who's trying to make their first or second horror movie right now, because apparently that contract was really big and the project looks incredible. And he is a friend of the show, so we've actually talked to him about what that next movie is going to be like, and let me tell listeners, it is something. I think people are going to be really excited to see that. So he's really great for the industry, and this movie was really, really important. When people said that Top Gun Maverick brought people back to theaters, I felt like that for Barbarian. I think it really brought people back to like enjoy being in that kind of collaborative experience of like laughing and talking to one another mid movie. Like, that just hasn't happened for me in a long time, probably since that Marvel Endgame Infinity War chapter ended. So I'm just really excited for his future, and this movie's great.
Yeah, I had someone next to me on, I think it was opening night the first time we went, and they were just doing a live commentary of the movie, and it was so welcome. Like, it was so much fun.
Yeah.
And then also, I think...
I'm glad you liked it. That would kill me.
Normally, I would not, but I think it was just so funny. And also, I was really loving the moments that were so unexpected, especially with Justin Long's character, AJ. Just brilliant casting. Yeah. And for people who didn't know he was in this movie, who don't, you know, follow movie news like us, it was just a huge surprise, I think, for people. And the scene of him measuring the basement.
Iconic.
To add to his Airbnb, you know, square footage of his house was amazing.
And that won't work for everyone, because we did bring a few friends, and one of the friends was like, nobody would really do that though. And I was like, okay, I mean, give it a second to like sit in, but it was really great. I love that scene.
But I mean, the reason I love this movie too, I think what you said is true about the comedic parts of it, but also the horror, is that we go in, I remember seeing the trailer thinking, okay, Bill Skarsgård is going to be the villain, and let's go see this. Like, I want to see him be the big bad in this house that our character Tess is stuck in. But then when his head gets smashed in right at the beginning of the movie, I was like, wait, you just killed the main antagonist. Where are we going from here? And the movie turns in a way that I really didn't expect. We meet Mother, who we expect to be the monster or barbarian of the movie, but we learn that she's actually a survivor trapped in the basement by the real monster, Frank. And there's also, like, Frank is the obvious monster of this movie, but AJ, you know, is also a monster in this movie too, and he's trying to distance himself from the abuse of Frank's serial abuse. And then we also have Keith, who's not a villain, but he ultimately is the reason Tess goes back into the basement, right? He has to see the room for himself, and doesn't really believe her about this. Well, maybe not believe her, but he needs to go check it out for himself. A camera with a bucket in a room, I would be gone. But so it is a really dark movie in a lot of ways, but I think you're right. It's a really, really fun movie experience and has a lot going on underneath the surface if you want to examine it.
Yeah. And for me, what it did is it just kind of, it gave me a very clear entryway to talk to, like, pitching some of my more unorthodox stories I have to people and saying, look, here's a movie that changes like 50 times and right. it's successful. You know, it starts out one thing, by act two it's something else, by act three it's something else. It changes aspect ratios from 185 to 166. It's like, it does everything. It's weird. It's a yeah. weird movie, you know. Yeah. And it's great. It's a great weird movie, and it kind of opened the door for a lot of other writers to say, please stop telling me my weird idea isn't marketable, because look at Barbarian.
Yeah.
And that's something I think it's so great that film did for so many creatives. But yeah, no, I mean, I just love watching a film and really being like, I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't have like a roadmap for what I think might happen. Because a lot of times you start watching a movie, even if you didn't watch the trailer and maybe you didn't really look that much into what it's about, you can still, maybe about 20, 30 minutes in, you have sort of an idea of, like, you know, I think, like, maybe it'll go this way, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like, you yeah. get the sense that that's going to happen. But with Barbarian, you don't know. It's just this, it seems like, okay, I wouldn't be with this guy right now in this weird Airbnb. He seems kind of strange, and something bad's going to happen to her, but they subvert that. And it's a good subversion. You're not like, oh, that's what you're doing. It's like, oh, shit, that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. you know, and it's really fun to kind of peel back the story in that way. But yeah, like I said, it's just a great invitation for writers who want to tell different stories. And they can say, look, Barbarian was successful. Take a shot. Take a chance on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, I'm really jealous that you got that. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I love what Chris said about the kind of subversive nature of the screenplay, because it really is dragging you in different places you didn't think you were going to go. Because I remember I was trying to look over here to see what it was at the time. I think it's Sid Field's screenplay book, or it was Save the Cat or something. I was reading a screenplay book at that time. I was like halfway through of seeing Barbarian. I remember getting home being like, I'll read the rest, but this guy just did something completely different that is going to make tens of millions of dollars. And Hollywood.
I could talk for an hour about Save the Cat. I could talk for an hour about that. Longer than that. Like, you can read those books and get like a sense of it, and it's good to know the rules yeah, and kind of what yeah. works, but then just throw it all out the window.
Yeah. Well, I was getting the language down pat, and I was like, okay, so you go here, here's the action point, here's going into the second act, and then you watch Barbarian, and it cuts to black, and you're cutting to, like, Justin Long singing a song in his car, and you're like,
I love that
okay,
scene.
Never mind. okay, so that was Barbarian. The first three picks of the first round were Nope, Pearl, and Barbarian. Now I have The Turn, so it'll be me, then Chris, and then Kelsey. So let's see here. I am going to go with a movie that is a little bit divisive, I think. I'm going to talk about why that is and maybe why I understand why that is. But I'm going to go with Alex Garland's Men. Alex Garland is one of my favorite filmmakers. So I'm going to be trying to be, I guess, as objective as possible here because the movie was poorly received and I really wanted to understand why. But I think the film, I don't like using the word misunderstood because I think we use it too often. It just, I think Hollywood puts a lot of movies out in poor taste about women, and this movie kind of fell into that like reaction, unfortunately. We dedicated a whole deep dive episode to this movie, which we loved at the time, and I still do. But I think, you know, people's reaction hearing reviews on it did, like, it didn't make me think that the movie wasn't as good, but like soured my relationship to it. So I'm trying to get it back. But I get why people acted the way they did. But I thought the overarching theme, or intention rather, of Men was to get audiences interested in a like historical analysis of division and power. Those are like really lofty ideas. But if you've watched Garland's work, you know he's got a lot of, I mean, he's an author first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And so he writes novels. And so you can feel that in his movies, that there are always these big ideas at the center of them. And I really think the movie is deeper than a gender commentary, even though that's already powerful enough. It is looking at like flawed institutions like religion and local law enforcement and trying to break those apart. And I've listened to Garland talk about his intentions before, and I do think he's like really self-aware and honest. And I think I can safely say Men is not a movie that's like heavily invested into like contemporary 2022 gender dynamics and toxic misogyny, like I think it was received, but rather it's trying to use contemporary issues as a vehicle to explore his idea of history and the way it's impacting our present and the ways that we've divided ourselves, and specifically how men, as the title shows us, have co-opted the power of women and appropriated not only their like individual talents, but also like their ability to create life, which I thought was, you know, I had to do some research because there's a lot of imagery in here that I wasn't familiar with. And we talked about this on our show, but there was imagery of the Sheila in a gig and the Green Man in the movie. And I didn't know anything about that. So we kind of do research for people on our episode.
Yeah, Trey did a deep dive on the mythology, so I didn't have to, but
yeah, I felt like that was like stuck in the house for a weekend.
I could tell, man. You got this down pat.
I'm a real nerd about Garland. I just like his stuff. And I think
He's great. He's fun. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah. And you know, I think I guess in terms of negative reactions, because I totally understand those. Like I said, I think the movie got fairly criticized, but I think it's because it's a Hollywood problem, like not necessarily a Garland men problem, like the movie men, obviously real men. Mm-hmm. But I think viewers have just like really kind of surface level expectations of any text on women's experiences in films because of, you know, just how poorly their stories have been treated in Hollywood. And I think people are kind of projecting a serious frustration that is valid of superficial films and stories that exploit women's experiences, especially by male filmmakers, onto this movie Men. So I get the criticism, but I do think the movie really, really works if you kind of try to explore the history of it, which I thought was I thought it was fun to kind of do that after the fact, which I usually don't like doing homework after a movie. Like I kind of really don't like that.
Yeah.
but this time I found it like fascinating to do that. So I like this film.
Yeah, I also think that I was surprised by the reaction because we left the theater and we were like, wow, I really loved this movie. And it was I quickly heard audiences and critics talk about how it was too elevated and also too on the nose. And for me, I was like, yeah, like that's the point for me. I think Men was refreshingly straightforward. I think Garland has talked about in interviews that he thinks sometimes people can tie themselves into, I think the term he used was sophisticated knots.
Right.
And then the message becomes unclear. And for me, I think Garland was creating an allegorical film. Like that's what he was aiming for. And so the choices really make sense for the goal. And I think that maybe people were judging it based off of different choices that they would have for a different goal. And so for me, like how it deals with gender dynamics, patriarchal institutions, religion, mythology, all through like a psychological thriller with horror elements was really effective to me. And I also think what you were saying about women in horror movies, especially like in horror movies, women experiencing violence is a reoccurring plot in horrors, but it's not often explored as like a concept. And women are often like forced to carry this burden of ensuring their own safety, right? And are often blamed for violence against them. And so I think Jessie Buckley's character is consistently put in situations where women are made to feel paranoid or like silly for having fear, which is also a theme from some other movies that I hoped I get to draft later on in this draft today.
Yeah.
But we see in both public and private spaces throughout the movie that she's justified in having that fear. And so it makes sense to me, this idea or the like threat of Rory Kinnear's multiple, right? That they're everywhere. Like his character represents, like you're saying, the history of power, which is like evident through his role as a policeman or a child or like a priest. And mm-hmm. the idea of men being born of men or like men being socialized by men or more so the power like in institutions, right? Like religion or law is the reason I love this movie. And I also thought like Jessie Buckley.
Yeah, she holds it down.
Yeah, so great. Like really great emotional performances. And then Rory Kinnear obviously was great playing all these different men.
only rivaled by Mark Rylance in a future movie that I'm sure someone will talk about. yeah, Men's great.
Yeah, I enjoyed the movie quite a bit. I got to see it in the theater. And I think like one of the reasons that sometimes like the general public can be a little hard on movies like this is because, you know, we can sit here and talk about like the meaning behind the movie and you're probably incredibly accurate. And I think both everything you guys said was super close to how I felt about the movie too. But most people go to a movie and they kind of want to understand what's happening while they're watching it. And Men is not a movie that kind of invites that kind of casual viewing experience. And sometimes people go like, if you watch the trailer for Men, it kind of maybe seems like Jessie Buckley is being stalked by somebody,
mm-hmm.
and that's really it, you know? And then you go to the movie and there's men like birthing men and like at the end you're like, what am I watching? So and I'm from Ohio, so like we're kind of on this Midwest, I'm not sure where you guys are, but I'm in like this Midwestern spot where like people go to the movie and they're like, I remember that people in the theater were like audibly saying what, like a lot. Yeah. And it was an interesting experience for me. Sometimes it can get annoying because I'm trying to invest myself into this vision that Alex Garland has. I do think he's a genius. And then other people are kind of, they just want to see like a creepy movie where there's a weird guy at the end of the tunnel and maybe he's going to attack her or something and chase her and follow her home or something. And that movie could be fun too. Like this is a normal thriller, but that's not what Men is. Men is all the things you guys said. It has a lot more on its mind and maybe a little too much on its mind. But yeah. Like, I think Alex Garland did a phenomenal job sort of piecing all of that together and trying to make a statement, which is dangerous. It's very dangerous for a man to say, I'm going to make a statement about how women feel about men in the world.
Yeah.
And I'm also a man at the same time. And mm-hmm. So you have to be careful. You know, you have to be careful when you're sort of making these sort of grand statements like that. And I think he did a good job at sort of like maintaining and not overstepping his bounds, so to speak.
Yeah. And because it was interesting because he was looking at those institutions as his premise. And so I think that's why it was ultimately successful for me too. And I recommend people rewatch it because I liked it even better the second time.
Yeah. It is a tough sit though. I mean, Chris, you're right. I mean, that's just something I forget.
What
I
think, said for people just wanting to go and like enjoy their movie.
That scene is really brutal where she's talking to her husband and they're having this very serious fight. The gaslighting is like obvious as like an idea in the scene, but like the powerful acting, it felt so real and grounded. And I think that probably was a lot for people to see, especially just like the fact we've all just lived life and have had relationships. And that was a really tough moments. Also just like a hero of the movie that didn't really get talked about was the cinematographer, Rob Hardy. Did great work. He worked on the Mission Impossible movie, I think in 2016, 2019. But there is some real, real good cinematography in this movie. I especially love the sequence where it's from the trailer, but you can see it when you see her reflection in the puddle and the tunnel.
Oh yeah.
And you kind of like see a skull, an outline. So yeah, that's all really, really cool. I like that. Okay. So I just got Barbarian and Men. Chris, you're up.
Okay. So technically this movie is ahead of Pearl on my best of the year list, but it's not like it's not like a horror movie, but it definitely is. Like on IMDb, it is listed as comedy, horror, thriller. So don't come at me when I say The Menu.
Oh, nice.
I saw The Menu at Fantastic Fest, and Mark Mylod, the director, was there. And it was one of the best theater experiences for me of 2022 because packed. I mean, every seat was filled. It was completely sold out. Everybody packed into like multiple theaters to go see this movie. And they presented at the end of the film, they actually had this whole thing. They presented like one of the dishes that they made in the movie for everybody.
Oh, wow.
It was a dessert dish that everyone got to eat. It was really exciting. It was fun. But I had no idea what the movie was about. I stayed away from marketing. I just knew there was probably satirical in some way. I just didn't really know exactly how. And I had no idea. I thought maybe they were eating people. And I'm glad that it was of like, you know. Yeah, it seemed like the obvious thing of like, well, they're probably cannibals and stuff. But it was cool that it went a different way because the thing and Ralph Fiennes, my God, I can't talk.
Oh,
about
yeah.
That.
Oh, good.
Man. Such an amazing underrated performance this year or last year. But Anya Taylor-Joy kind of becoming the hero because she's sort of like brought there to this place where they're doing these amazing dishes for people to try. And it's just like this hyper expensive food for these hyper rich assholes to just eat one bite of and then throw away. and she's just kind of there like, I want a cheeseburger. And so I immediately connect with her, you know, and so do most people who watch the movie, which is a great tool from the script. Comes from one of the writers of Succession, which Mark Mylod has also directed a lot of Succession. And so this being his first feature, which is remarkable, I believe, but he's done a ton of TV before this. And sort of the choices they made to make the movie digestible, no pun intended, for for your general audiences, but also to sort of put things in there that folks like us who watch a lot of movies can really kind of sink your teeth into, again, no pun intended. it kind of had a lot. Apparently I use a lot of food metaphors in my movies. No, I had such a great time with the movie. I found it hilarious, but also had great violence in it. Amazing performances. Nicholas Hoult, so funny in it, but also tragic. A really tragic performance, because he's there like desperately clinging for this guy's approval, the lead chef, and he's just not going to get it. And you feel so kind of terrible when he doesn't get it. And of course his fate. Also, I really want to make sure I say this name right. Is it Hong Chau?
Yeah, yeah.
Who plays Elsa, who's amazing in The Whale as well. She, that's the first time I remember really noticing her in a movie, and she really blew me away in that, and The Whale. So, I don't know, man. This movie had everything I wanted. It made me laugh. It had incredible cinematography, great performances, a very fast pace, but also, like, beyond the casting and how much money was probably spent on that. It is a fairly contained movie, which is also something that, again, from the filmmaking side, is very attractive to people when you're trying to finance a movie, that it mostly takes place in this kind of singular location. Not that it's not an expensive movie, because it clearly is, but they really went all out. But there's a version of this movie that isn't. And that probably, like I said, with Shelby Oaks, is something that kind of started the ball rolling initially, as they were like, well, it's in a contained spot, you know, and there's it's kind of one building and they're doing things and they're eating food. And then eventually they're like, let's get Ralph Fiennes. just like make the, you know, the big version of this. I don't know if that's how it happened. I'm just spitballing, but I loved everything about The Menu.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have co-writer Seth Reese on the show, and he was talking about how this movie got made, and him and Will Tracy, that writer from Succession, or one of the producers and writers from Succession, they worked at, or I think still work at The Onion, and they wrote for, I think, different like late night shows. And so they've had a long career of satire and comedy, and this has been like on their plate. Oh my God, I just did it for a while.
It's hard, man. It's hard.
It's difficult. Yeah, so they've been thinking about this script for a long time. And yeah, he was super cool about the movie and just like talking about the themes, because I was really trying to, I've been trying to think about the constant theme we've been getting lately. It's been really popular, and I can't tell if I like it or not about the whole Eat the Rich commentary of this past 2 years in a lot of our movies. But I do think The Menu is doing something a little bit more interesting about the artist. And if we were to like intellectualize the movie, which this movie's asking you not to, but let's just do that for a second. Like the whole Ralph Fiennes character, like just wanting to make food and not have to like monetize it, and like he's forced to though, and I think that is fascinating. And then you kind of have like Hung Chau's performance is amazing, and she probably got the Oscar nom for The Whale because of performances like this year too that are in the back of people's minds. But that scene where she's like telling like those stock traders or whatever they are, like that just terrible things in their ears, like whispering terrible things in their ears, those are all really funny. And I love the comment on like the fanboy culture through Nicholas Hoult's character. I had to like kind of think about myself when talking about movies for a second, when thinking about the way he was talking about food and the chef. So loved everything in the movie. I think an underrated part of it, which is really hard to do in a movie like this, is to have the sharp edits and not be taken out of it, because there's a lot of editing between like dishes and meals and courses. And the way that they kind of, they do the edit is so smart, because they put like the description of every course in a funny way, like in the top, you know, corner of the movie. Yeah. And then at the end when they make the, you know, the final cheeseburger, I just love the way they do that. So one of the coolest movie experiences this year too, we saw at the Alamo, I think, and they did like a special thing for it too.
Yeah. A really another fun theater experience too. I totally agree. And I think I agree with everything that you all said. It's a really just interesting, unique movie. I was wondering though, Chris, when they served you the food, were you like at all afraid?
Yeah, like what's gonna be this what's gonna be moment. Underneath this, like a picture of like me when I was a child or something? Like,
yeah,
what
what's
do they
your
know?
Fate?
No, I was happy to. It was free dessert. I ate it.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I would have taken the cheeseburger if they would have gave that. That would have been great.
Of course, yeah. Well, I saw it at the Alamo Draft House as well. Okay. You know, because Fantastic Fest. So I think I was actually eating a cheeseburger from the restaurant, but like, you know, at the beginning of the movie. So
yeah, loved it. Loved The Menu. Okay, Kels, you have back-to-back picks now.
Oh, I do. Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot you can do here.
Oh wow. Okay. I'll just go with my first one, and then I'll make a decision on the fly. Okay. So you took Barbarian and Men, which I wanted.
And then Chris took The Menu.
Yes. I'll go ahead and go with Watcher.
Okay.
For my
oh,
second
nice.
Pick.
That was my next one. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah. So yeah. Written and directed by Chloe Okuno. I love how this movie, this is what I was talking about when I was responding to your men draft pick, but I love how this movie plays with doubt. One from the characters, but also from the audience. Characters in the story are doubting Julia, which then evolves to Julia doubting herself. And then we also have, maybe more importantly, the audience begin to doubt Julia's experience. Mm-hmm. And we also see this idea of doubt, or like this flawed system to help women, show up in other movies this year, like Resurrection and Men and Fresh, and probably others that I can't think of right now, but where women are in danger or uncomfortable, but people are quick to either push it off or, you know, need evidence in order to help. And Chloe Okuno actually said in the commentary that she wanted the audience to doubt Julia. Like, is she overreacting? Is she just a privileged American who doesn't know her surroundings and therefore is afraid? Because she wants to get at something that we kind of don't have language around, which is the idea that Julia, when she's being watched or when she's in danger, it's not always overt, but it's a real horror that women experience. And I really recommend people go back and watch the commentary because it was great to hear her talk about it more. But I think my favorite scenes that kind of have examples of this are the movie theater scene, which is so, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then also the grocery store scene.
Yes.
Because Chloe shows these two situations where there's dread and fear that are happening for Julia. But this idea of this fear or threat can happen both in a dark space, like the movie theater, right? Which many audience members can probably recognize. But also for women, specifically Julia, right? There's the extremely well-lit place where there are a bunch of people around at the grocery store, and she's still experiencing this threat and is trying to navigate it. And I think when Francis, her husband, suggests that they go see the tapes, he says something like, well, maybe the man is looking at the person who's looking at him. Yeah. And also the cops, you know, are like, well, you think that's the same man, or you know? And that kind of all leads to that horrifying moment where she waves in the window. And, you know, because after she has a drink with Irina, who I'm blanking on the actress's name, but she's amazing. Uh-huh. But, you know, she thinks that she's being silly, Julia. And so she waves at the watcher, who waves back. And I think it's because she doesn't believe herself in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. That she is in a really vulnerable situation and has to test it for herself. So I love Watcher. It is better on rewatch for me. I think it has a lot of what I want from a horror movie. And we did, I think, an It Follows in Watcher pod, right, earlier this year?
Yeah, we did that with James.
Yep. For in honor of Micah Monroe, mm-hmm. the icon.
Yeah. I love when you watch a movie. We unfortunately didn't get to see this in theaters, so we saw mm-hmm. it on AMC Plus streaming on Shudder, I think. But I love when you watch a movie and you go, is this going to be a classic?
Yeah.
Like, is this an underappreciated horror genre film? And you know, I think this might actually go into like some of my horror classics of the recent years. I love everything about this movie. Everything you just said is like basically what I was gonna say too. I think it has something that we forget we need in our movie culture, which is we need rewatchability. And there is like something about this film, I mean, themes aside, that are all very poignant and important, it does have like a TNT cable-like rewatchability yeah. to it. There yeah. is something Disturbia. I don't know if you remember the Shia LaBeouf
of
movie,
course.
Disturbia.
Yeah.
yeah. There's something like rewatchable about
how
this
could you
movie.
Forget?
Yeah, of course. But it's also just like really well-crafted, like you said. It feels yeah. like I'm watching a David Fincher Hitchcock fanatic make a movie, which I'm assuming like Chloe Okuno must be one because, I mean, I'm a David Fincher head. So like watching this movie, I'm just thinking of like his films. And that's impressive. That's not a hard thing to do. When people say that, my least favorite film criticism ever is that something is derivative and it's like repeating another filmmaker's mm-hmm. sensibilities or literal shots or whatever, because that all looks at like inspired to me for the most part. And this movie feels inspired. And then you have the satisfying ending and just kind of seeing Michael Monroe's character at the end of the film, like on a train across from Bern Gorman's character.
Oh, yeah.
And as the viewer, you're left kind of like really to the end wondering about why you're paranoid, because it's obviously like Michael Monroe is obviously going through this tragic experience. But I think what happens on that train is done so well. almost to the point where I think I said in our episode earlier this year that I kind of wish it ended there. Like, I wish it ended there with
the
kind of
the grocery bag.
Yeah, just this kind of like ambiguity. Not that the movie's condescending to the audience at all, but like telling us things, like literalizing things. But I loved that moment where she sees the grocery bag and she sees him sitting across from him, and you're kind of, it's in the corner of the frame and you're kind of looking at it. You're looking at the bag and you're like, what is that? Is that what I think that is? And mm-hmm. then you realize that is what you think it is. And the movie just plays to that tension really, really well. And I think we're in really comfortable hands with Chloe Acuno for the future. I already know she's signing deals for future movies. So again, another like first time feature filmmaker in horror kind of cementing their name in the genre and being able to get future movies is incredible.
Yeah. What does he ask for? An apology in that scene, right?
Yeah. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's great. She's going to make a lot of great stuff. And I Watcher was the first movie that I saw in theaters after wrapping Shelby Oaks.
Oh, wow.
So I was burnt out. I was like, I had just, you know, wrapped my first feature. It was, you know, a month of just endless shooting a movie. And before that was a month of pre-production, and just, you know, I was ready to go to a theater and watch somebody else's movie and sort of like forget about mine for a second and just sort of disappear into somebody else's. And I was so glad that it was a good movie, because I think like on the surface, you look at a movie, like you watch the trailer for the movie, and it's like, okay, so Rear Window-esque, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it's ground that's been well traveled. But when the movie begins, you get your tastes of that, but it really does have a great way of going in a different direction and sort of expanding on things that have been done before in movies like Disturbia or Rear Window, and finding ways to, like you said, explore the female perspective of, you know, is there really a threat, or am I just being paranoid right now? And how that feels sometimes when you know you're being followed or feel mm-hmm. like you're being followed. I mean, just the other day when I was driving home, it was like, I don't know, like 3 days ago, I was driving home from the office where I shoot my videos at like 2:30 in the morning. And somebody was behind me for almost the entire drive, all the way onto like the side street of my house.
No, thank
and
you.
Of course it could be a coincidence, of course. And it probably was, but it was still unnerving because every turn I was like, well, they're still there and there's nobody else around but this guy. And so I think everybody can relate to the idea of, I feel like I'm being followed, or I feel like I'm being watched. And so there's also this universality to the movie too, where no matter who you are, you get the sense of like, I understand how unnerving this would be if I never fully feel safe wherever I go. But yeah, Micah Monroe is incredible in the movie, and it is shot beautifully. Because a lot of films that, not to talk down to films of that show up on certain streaming platforms, but sometimes you expect them to look worse than Watcher does. Watcher mm-hmm. looks amazing.
Yeah,
it really does. It sort of, like, it feels like it's punching above its weight class a bit in regards to like how beautiful it looks and how well composed it is. And yeah, I thought it was great. I was so glad it was one of the first, like actually the first movie I saw after shooting one.
Yeah. I'm jealous you got to see it in theaters. That is one thing I wish, because the movie is, there's a lot of blacks in the movie, and I've said this before on the podcast, but our TV doesn't do well with blacks. We got to upgrade the TV soon.
Yeah.
Okay. So
get
Watcher
an LG OLED. They're the best for it.
Yes. Yeah, I know. We're just like, every year I'm like, Black Friday, we'll just wait around that time. And then I get there, I'm like, I thought I was going to be saving a little bit more money on this. Okay, so you got Watcher, Kelsey. So the round two, I had Men, Chris had The Menu, Kelsey, you had Watcher. Round three, we're starting off with Kels, then going to Chris, and then I will get the third pick. What do you got, Kels?
Awesome. Okay, so my next pick is going to be Nanny.
Oh, nice.
And I have a little less to say about this because I just watched it last night. But so I have to engage with my ranking of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But Nanny focuses on Aisha, played by Anna Diop, who's a woman that recently moved to New York City from Senegal, where she was a teacher. But now in New York, she's hired to care for the daughter of an affluent family, played by Michelle Monaghan and Morgan Spector.
Mm-hmm.
And we get some really effective, surreal horror elements in this film that I love, like disturbing imagery of drowning and blood and spiders. But ultimately, the movie functions as this psychological horror and even drama throughout the movie, where we focus on the grief that Aisha is dealing with because of the absence of her son while she's having to take care of someone else's child. And the movie is ultimately tragic. But I think it also, beyond just, you know, following a really developed character story, there's also a really effective example for how Aisha is exploited, and then also the intersections of race and gender and class. And I really recommend people go watch this movie.
Yeah. So we just watched this last night, and like you said, and I felt really stupid because we did our 2022 movie draft, and I was like, this is going to be pretty high for me. I really, really like this movie a lot. It is the feature debut from writer-director Nikiatu Jusu. I believe is how you say her name. I'm sorry if I messed that up. It is a must watch. The movie is everything Kelsey said. It is like about the plight of immigrants into the United States, specifically the African-American immigrants, and about the hardships of disadvantaged American labor classes that are like obviously and often disguised as opportunities. And they hold all these themes together so seamlessly in an effective, like haunting, naturalistic, but like surrealist way. Like the filmmaking really, it asks you to believe in it. And it took me like 30 minutes because it is kind of meta in a sense. And when I finally bought in, I was like really just floored with how masterful Jusu is in this movie, because it's her first film. And she's like weaving like these difficult themes in like a fairly like abstract mythological story that I was not familiar with. And I usually, it takes me always a second with supernatural horror, and I always find myself loving them by the end, but it always gives me, because when I don't do, because we try not to watch trailers anymore. So like when we go into movies and we see it's a supernatural horror, it's always a surprise to me. And then I sit in and I'm like, okay, I love what's happening here. I love what this represents. I'm really buying into this. And this movie dealing with like power dynamics of race and ethnicity, and then using that kind of genre to kind of explain this like driving motivation of a mother trying to get her son back is just really powerful. And it, we're still picking it apart because we saw it so recently, but it does all those things so well. And if you're a horror fan that's like, I don't really want to like kind of unpack all these things right now, I just want to be immersed into this like horror story, it does that for you too, because it shows you the horrors of like a child care service job, which maybe people don't talk about, but that is like horrifying. And for anybody who's ever worked in that, that part of the industry, it really works like that in a terrifying way. It shows you the suspense of working in that job and dealing with these like affluent parents. So I think it's a really special first feature. And I believe, kind of going back to Anna Diop, who plays the lead character, that it might be a star-making role for her. I mean, she had that small role in Jordan Peele's Us as the mother of the main character at the beginning.
Yeah.
But she's just great in this one.
I will have to watch it. I have not yet seen that one. You guys have definitely sold me on it, though.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of people haven't seen it just because I don't know if, I don't believe it came to theaters, and I think it just dropped to streaming recently. All right, Chris, you're up with the next pick. What do you got?
Okay. So I apologize if I'm taking one from anybody, but we're going to talk about The Black Phone.
Oh, let's do it.
So, The Black Phone. So I really like, Scott Derrickson. I think he's just an absolutely incredible filmmaker. And see Robert Cargill as a writer too, all the way, you know, their first big collaboration on Sinister, I think has, you know, really kind of set the bar for scares and horror and what you could accomplish for a relatively small budget. And it's also a movie, Sinister, that kind of did something that I found remarkable on upon rewatch, is that you're sort of just waiting for Ethan Hawke to watch stuff. And you just want to watch a guy watch stuff, which is very fascinating to me. And it's like, it's almost like you're watching a reactor channel, but it's like a terrible 8mm videos or a film. So when it comes to Black Phone, I was excited to see them do something together again after their collaboration on Doctor Strange. And it's been so long for me that there's been like a new masked killer that I thought could potentially enter into a realm of being iconic, and to get Ethan Hawke to play him and be surprisingly big, you know, and have shirtless scenes and stuff. And I think that he just proved he's one of the most versatile actors, because I can watch the Before trilogy and just absolutely fall in love with him. Fuck, Julie Delpy? Did I just mess that up?
No, you didn't.
Julie
fine.
Delpy?
You're fine.
Okay.
Julie Delpy, you're good.
Yeah. Okay. For a second, I was like, oh no, that's my favorite romance trilogy. to see him in that movie and feel like I understand him, to watch him in Reality Bites, Ben Stiller's movie, and he's just like this Gen X like stoner, and then to see him as a serial killer who wears a mask, range. So Black Phone for me was another great audience experience. I saw it at a packed screening, and it was like some kind of early thing that was only done at AMC theaters. It wasn't an advanced screening like with, for the press. I bought a ticket on Fandango and went. It was weird. But it was super early, and everybody, I mean, people were like really into this movie. And for those who have not seen it, I'm going to talk about the ending. But when our lead character, played by Mason Thames, who plays Finney, gets, you know, he gets to kill the grabber, I mean, the entire theater erupted, like just absolutely erupted. It was a great moment. And it's also like, it's very investing from on a mystery standpoint too, when you watch his sister, played extremely well by Madeline McGraw, sort of use this gift she thinks she might have, and also talk some shit to Jesus, you know, and like blaming him for not being able to find her brother. I really just thought that it had everything that makes a movie like this fun for an audience, but also inspiring enough to think like I could write something like that, and maybe that could be made. Yeah, definitely one of my favorites of last year.
Yeah, a lot of great child performances in that movie. Yeah, especially from the sister. And I think when you were saying she was praying, did she kind of have like a sixth sense, like Jesus house?
There was some
like
kind of Shyamalan vibe going on.
Yeah, it was like a little dollhouse.
Okay. I was, because we just recently watched that for Knock on the Cabin. But so I totally agree with everything you said. It was such a fun theater experience too, like so many this year. And I think just having a like kid in a basement is not something that I would immediately, you know, think, okay, I'm going to be in this for the whole movie. But I really felt the suspense from the kids from the past helping him out. Like, it could become cheesy. I could see it, you know, kind of going off in the wrong direction, but it all really worked for me, all the supernatural elements. And even though we didn't see Ethan Hawke do that much, he was doing so much. He was amazing. And I really just loved this as a thriller. Loved Ethan Hawke. And Trey, I think you called that they were in the house, right? That Ethan Hawke was also in.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but
Or the guy that the cops are like investigating or coming into. I was just getting a
but it was still fun for me.
Game night vibes from the comedy. Yeah, I really, really like this movie, and it's the one I regret not rewatching before this draft because I might have taken it higher. Or I tried to have gotten it. And something I think is under like rated from this year, and I don't like talking about box office too much on the podcast, but this movie made like $150 million or something like that. It made a crazy number, and it did not have the budget of something like The Menu, which is, I think it had like a $30, $40 million budget. This was like more in like the 10 to 15 range. And that is really hard to do with marketing. And I was really impressed. I think a lot of it has to do with Ethan Hawke is coming to horror. Like, that's who's coming to a horror movie. And also, I think it's a Stephen King adaptation. So that really helped kind of push people to the theater.
Stephen King's son, Joe Hill.
His son? Okay.
Yeah, it was written by, based off a story that he had written, Joe Hill.
Okay, very cool. That makes sense about why the daughter is that way. Yeah, and by the way, like Gwen, the daughter, she's played by Madeline McGraw. She is incredible. Lights out with the father. And the father's really good. The guy who plays the father is really great too. The one thing about the movie that I wish, I don't know, maybe it was just me overreading it, but like at the end, I thought they were going to connect something with the dad. I thought there was going to be something there about like it being, you know how horror movies do it. It's like the slasher is terrible, but also your home life is terrible, and trying to connect those two things and tell this like meta story of like how you feel like you're like the grabber lives at home with you always. And I thought that was the kind of the relationship to the father. But all that aside, like I just was completely floored by the movie. It's a really crazy chance to kind of like take this really scary story of kids being stolen. Like, I think that is like a Stephen King-esque trope at this point, but it is like really, really well done. I think Bakes Repetta is one of the kids, and he's the child actor from Armageddon Time. So he had a really big year too. So yeah, I really like this
movie. I forgot
he
was in that. Okay.
Yeah. Black Phone's great. Okay. So I have back-to-back picks here. God, guys. All right. This is where it starts getting hard because we're about to end round three. We'll have two more rounds after this. All right. I'm going to go with one of my guys from this year that I did a long pod on. I was solo on that one. Kels was busy. I'm going to go with Luca Guadagnino's Bones and All.
Nice.
Guadagnino is a creative genius. I think we are lucky to have him. He's got Challengers coming out in August or September, and that's going to be with Zendaya and some other great actors too. I think it's a tennis movie. I don't know what this guy's going to do with tennis. I also think it's like a romance and there's a lot of conflict in there. So he's probably going to do a lot with tennis and romance. I'm just excited to see what he's going to do. His writer, David Kajanik, who he always has on his projects, came on the show actually, and we had a really, I thought, insightful conversation because he's really just like a powerful author,
yeah,
a lot like Garland. And so he is always thinking about the symbolism and metaphors of his scripts that he works on.
And a former teacher, shout out.
Yeah, and former teacher. And yeah, so he's great. And he's worked on Guadagnino's films like A Bigger Splash and Suspiria. And Suspiria is like an iconic horror movie. At this point, I think it's like one of my favorites of the past like 7-8 years. And oh yeah, this movie has Timothée Chalamet with, I think, his best performance since Beautiful Boy. And there is one scene in particular where Chalamet is dancing in his room. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely our DiCaprio. Like, that's our Leo. Cause I haven't seen that. There's something about Chalamet's movies where he is so humble as a performer. At least he gives off that vibe where he's not always fully confident in his roles. And to the point where I almost like it, I can't tell what he's saying, even when he's like speaking, like he's mumbling a lot and you can tell he's like not fully buying in. But this is the movie to kind of get yourself in an uncomfortable zone. You're playing a cannibal. And so he definitely goes for it. And then we also get a new star in Taylor Russell.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of big names on this project. And on top of all those people, bringing back the Mark Rylance thing I said earlier, we have him as Sully, which is, I think, hands down one of the craziest performances I've ever seen. It's awesome. It really, really works for me. It hits capital A acting. And I know some people are going to be out on it, but the movie's about cannibals. Like, so I think I bought in fully. And I guess just talking about the story really quickly, like on the surface, obviously it's like a brutal horror movie about like these two young kids, adults, making their way through kind of like Reagan's America and coming back in themes of horror movies and living on the fringes of society. And it's a very complex fable about how people are radicalized when they're put in harsh conditions. And I think Russell, as Marin, kind of holds the movie's extreme symbolism together. Even though I said everything I did about Chalamet, she kind of is the heart of the movie. And you know, Marin's the lead character and the performance is like really disarming, but it's also unnerving enough to make you kind of like, what is this character going through? How much should I be believing in this like journey they're on? And then when you unpack the text, it is a really nuanced coming of age drama about isolation and being othered because of your identity and your sexuality. And then Luca and David do a fantastic job contextualizing those themes and also things like poverty and homelessness. Like, these are really tough ideas that they put in this movie. And it's an adapted screenplay from a great book, but still, it's a really hard thing to adapt on screen. And I think they really capture the way people are who feel invisible in society and what lengths they'll go to be seen and how they've been pushed out and how they're pitted against one another to survive. And these cannibals are kind of like, they're eaters. They are like a manifestation of disparity. And the writing is so phenomenal in that way. And I think another unsung DP is Arseny Khachaturian. This is one of his first films. Mm-hmm. I thought he deserved a nomination for this movie. There's a lot of moments where you're just staring at Timothée Chalamet's face, like on a mountainside. And like, obviously it's Chalamet. So like, yeah, but it's also this like beautiful landscape that he's captured in the background, which looks great. I think it's some of the best cinematography since I've seen last year, Drive My Car, Hamaguchi's film. And yeah, I mean, if you're a horror fan, there's enough here for you. And if you want to hear more about this movie, I talked about it in depth and I did a whole Chalamet top 10 ranking because he's our guy. So yeah, I love Bones and All. I'm here for Guadagnino. Whatever he's got coming up, I'm going to watch it. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I think they made something that's a really surreal concept. And I know we said it's adapted from a book as well, but something that feels so surreal as a story, but it feels so grounded when you watch it. And that's what I was surprised about most, especially I know I'm not as great with body gore. Like, I had some tough times in the first couple scenes where they start eating. But I think everything that you said, like the love story, the coming of age story and being outcasted by society, I thought it was really successful as a drama and this thriller horror gore element. The only thing that you didn't say about Mark Rylance is he was also in a film, I think it was like 2021 or 2022 when it came out, but Phantom of the Open.
Yeah, yeah.
If you haven't seen that, a totally different character than Sully, but you should definitely check it out.
So good. That's Craig Roberts, I think. That's his filmmaking debut, I'm pretty sure. It might be his second film. Craig Roberts is famously from that show we love from Amazon Prime, Red Oaks.
Yeah. It has the same vibes.
He directs that movie, and he's also a very young filmmaker. So yeah, love that.
I also have a strange Mark Rylance movie to recommend that's not Bones and All, but it's called The Outfit, and people should watch it.
Yes.
It came out last year. It's a great thriller, and he's amazing in it. And yeah, check that one out. But I saw Bones and All at Fantastic Fest as well, and you were talking about the cinematography, and I couldn't agree more. It's shot on 35mm, so immediately I'm drooling. You know, I desperately wanted to shoot Shelby Oaks on film, but it was just not feasible. But maybe in the future I'll be able to, because I just love the look of it. But the film really did look like a 1990s movie, like in so yeah. many ways. And even like the shadows even that they did with like there's this scene early on where she's climbing out of a window and there's shadows of like tree branches and the leaves against the siding of the house. And it looked like John Carpenter's Halloween. Like it just
yes.
was beautiful. The whole movie is astoundingly good looking. And it really did feel like it was shot in the early 90s. And like they didn't focus on production design. Like here's a bunch of 1980s or 90s cars. Look at all the stuff we put in the road. They were sort of almost always like deep focus way in the background. Like it just felt like you were watching a movie of whatever era they were aiming for. But yeah, Taylor Russell, man, I mean, I had seen her, what was it, Escape Room that she was in, I think?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, but she really did blow me away here. Chloe Savini, I think that's how you say her name. I might be saying it wrong, in one scene, really strong. Yeah, I mean, I also love the structural idea of her dad gives her a tape, and the tape is like instructional, and kind of she can play it when she needs to, and you get a little bit of information, some exposition is delivered. Mm-hmm. It's really smart from a storytelling perspective too. But also I've never really seen, to my recollection currently as I sit here, a cannibal movie where someone thinks they might be like the only one. And then they sort of start to meet other people who have these strange, because it's not just like a person who feels like eating another person.
Yeah,
you know, there's more to it in this movie. They can kind of like sense when another one's around.
Yeah
they can smell each other.
It's
interesting. Like it's not just the same old. They had a really good way of doing that. And again, yeah, Mark Rylance is just, I mean, we were talking earlier about people who kind of came into their own or discovered their passion, or at least we noticed them later in life. And that he would be one of them. Cause I remember the first time I saw him was Bridge of Spies. He already had gray hair, and now he's just everywhere. And he's just amazing. Such an incredible talent.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I love him.
He's great. Yeah. He had a big year. Okay. So that was Bones and All. My next pick I'm struggling with.
And then
yeah.
I go.
Okay. Yeah. I have back to back. So, okay. Then Chris goes and then you go.
Okay.
Yeah. So our third round, Kelsey had Nanny, Chris picked The Black Phone, I picked Bones and All. And now I will be picking, I don't know, I'm stuck between three movies, it looks like here. I'm going to go with Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. So we had director Helena Rain on the podcast. I believe she signed a deal with it. Yeah, she's awesome.
Yeah.
I think she signed a deal with A24. So I'm hoping to have her on again on the show. A top three guest for me, I think. Personally, like just someone to hang out and talk about movies with. She was so dope. Like she's incredible. Bodies is her second movie, actually. Her first is called Instinct, which we didn't have access to in the States. So I had to like somehow watch it on my phone. But recently, because A24 has a tight relationship with her, I think they just bought the rights to it. So now you can rent that movie. I recommend people check that out, because even though I love Bodies, I think Instinct is phenomenal. It's dealing with a lot of tough themes. So people should probably read the log line before checking that one out. But I think Helena Rain is like a master of psychological terror. And I think Bodies is a prime example of that. What's fascinating is how she made it so commercial. And I mean that in the best way possible. Like this movie could have been a lot darker, a lot more rough around the edges, and kind of have those men vibes where it kind of pushes people out of the theater. But I think what's fascinating is the reaction to the movie, because people loved it. But I thought that the movie didn't necessarily, and we talked about this on our show, but like the movie didn't necessarily critique a specific generation. It just kind of used that as the vehicle for other ideas, which is often how these horror movies work. But I thought she was like really interested in the superficiality of like constructs and how we all participate in them and how we can lose ourselves when we're addicted to things. And obviously addictive behavior can be through the obvious things like drugs and alcohol, but it could also be things like social media and phones or money and wealth and privilege. And so she kind of uses social media, Gen Z, also millennials, to kind of get that idea across, because the movie works on so many levels beyond that. Like, for example, Maria Bakalova, who's incredible in this movie, so glad she got another opportunity to do something. And now I think she'll get a lot of opportunities. Her character B is like terribly treated throughout the movie. And we're watching this like group of like, at the very least, upper middle class friends at this like hurricane party where they're playing a game where they fake kill each other. And they inevitably blame the only person who is not from the United States. And like, therefore, they are an outsider to this group of rich young people. So I thought that was all really clever and meta, because Helena Rain is Dutch and she's making her first film in the United States. So I'm sure that must have been odd. She talked about how that was a weird experience. So yeah, this movie is great. And I think it is a fun one to compare, specifically because of this week and what we'll be covering on our show this week, Scream.
Oh, yeah.
I think we've been missing something to speak to the angst and anxiety of a generation that has grown up in the internet era, like all of us. And I think Bodies doesn't have to be the one. I think we're in a time where we can have many movies like Scream that are meta like that. And I think this can be one of many if it isn't already. So it is like a meta horror and I love that. And I hope we get more of these whodunits that can also be sold as other subgenres like slashers. Because when we went into it, we were like guessing who the killer was going to be, like when we went into Bodies. And spoiler alert, the killers are basically themselves and there isn't really a killer. And so I thought that was really well done, and it wasn't completely obvious until like the third act, which is always nice. Mm-hmm. And considering that we're living in a world full of like memes and satire right now, I love the idea that we're poking fun at ourselves in Bodies. So it's one of my favorite horrors of the year. I probably should have drafted it like sooner, but I thought I could hold out on this one.
Yeah. I feel like people got upset with this movie because it was kind of marketed as like a slasher.
Yes,
but
it was.
Yeah. It was more of a like whodunit murder mystery with like glow sticks and social media. And but I loved this movie. It was a lot of fun. I keep saying this for every movie, but it was a really fun theater experience too. I guess it was just for all of these.
Horror movies are great.
We had a great horror movie year. But I think you're right. Like, obviously a lot of people left talking about the kind of buzzwords that the Gen Z, Zillennial, whatever, you know, characters were using. And that was obviously there. And I was worried actually at first that it was going to be cringy because there was one thing that Rachel Sennett said that I was like, oh, you know, but ultimately, like, I think it really worked out because it's so funny. And also what you're talking about with social media in this horror thriller movie, we have social media being kind of a vehicle for just people in general to look at like, what do people do when they feel exposed, mm-hmm. or this kind of like funny comment of groupthink with the online world or instant reactions that not just Gen Z is guilty of, but a lot of, you know, people might be as far as the decisions that they're making at their like fingertips with all the information online.
Yeah.
But just one thing that you didn't say, but is that Rachel Sennett just like took this movie for me.
She's really great.
I loved her. You know, it's really hard to make a podcast.
Yeah.
You
know? that hit definitely different, like watching it. That's around the time where we're like halfway through the year of our pod. And I remember really laughing a lot at that joke. There is a lot of great jokes, like you're silencing me in this, like you're upper middle class. Like all of that is really awesome. And the performances are all great across the board. Pete Davidson playing like a real like meta role, and like him knowing what the public thinks of him adds another layer of interest that I didn't think I would have in his like acting career. Yeah. Like I'm gonna watch a lot of his movies now. And Lee Pace also, which I should have brought up, like I didn't realize he was like an American heartthrob until this movie. He got a lot of love online, but he is really, really fun in that role.
Yeah, that gym scene is so fun.
It's great.
They were like, wait, you said he was a vet, right? Why do you call him G.I. Joe?
Yeah, I liked it a lot too. Saw it with the fairly packed theater. Definitely a lot of the jokes landed. I haven't laughed at the reveal of a quote unquote killer like this before.
Yeah.
Because it's not really a reveal of a killer. And so, you know, but when they're watching that video on the phone, I was like, okay, I did not expect that.
Yeah.
There's a lot about the movie I love. I don't have as much to say about it as you guys because it's not fresh in my mind. I saw it once and I'm incredibly busy and it has kind of dissipated a bit, but I do remember really being into it. I know I reviewed it, so I obviously enjoyed it. But I think that for me, the things that stood out the most was, I loved the feel of it. I love, you know, a movie like Clue where it's people and they're trapped in a storm and, mm-hmm. and they're trying to figure something out. That's always going to feel kind of cozy. And this movie had that for sure. But also, yeah, I mean, there's the whole idea of like, are we destroying ourselves? You know, are we just in a cyclical nature of eating ourselves alive, so to speak, on the internet? And will there be progress, or are we just going to, be stuck in this whirlpool? And so that's a pretty fun way of looking at the movie too.
Yeah, it's like this lack of reflection that leads to chaos.
Yes. I like just seeing like my PTSD about past Facebook posts materialized in a movie. Like just like having regret of putting yourself online is really relatable. Okay, so I had Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. Chris, you're up, and then Kels with two picks in a row.
So we're getting into stuff because you guys have taken some of the ones I would have said like nope. But we're getting into some of stuff that for me, I know, like, they weren't necessarily considered best of the year or anything, but they represent something that I would love to see more of. And one of those for me is Idris Elba's Beast.
Oh, nice.
So Beast is by no means like some masterpiece. You know, it is exactly what the trailer sells it as. It's Idris Elba and his family, and there is a lion, and they're trapped, and the lion could eat him. And I really miss movies like that, where a studio gives money to a filmmaker to create a tense, real-time-ish horror film where you are pitted against a primal force. Because it's something that, again, is universal. There's universality there. Everyone understands if I'm there with my children and there is a primal force of nature that is going to try to eat them, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that doesn't happen. And you're not fighting for the audience's attention. Everybody gets that immediately. You know exactly the type of movie you're watching, and you can hopefully relate to the hero. And Idris Elba also, I thought, elevated the movie too. I just thought he was phenomenal in it and so, so good. For a movie that relies almost entirely on a CGI monster, it was pretty convincing. And I have to say, you know, there's about three scenes that are all done in one take, one of which involves like eight CGI lions on a rock and about 20 different shot setups from close-ups to mediums to wides.
Jeez.
And I was, like I said in my review, that I was just picturing the first AC, the focus puller behind the camera, like trying to make sure the focus never goes soft. And it actually was quite remarkable, the choices the director made to sort of differentiate itself from your standard VOD fare. It really did feel like he was going above and beyond to try to create an experience that felt more immersive. And I saw it twice. I took my mom to it. My mom loves creature movies. You know, she loves those kind of, it kind of felt, it was nice. I miss very simple horror like that. I think mm-hmm. you should have your Bodies, Bodies, Bodies and your men. And you should also be able to go watch Idris Elba run from a big fucking lion.
That's sick. Yeah, now I kind of want to watch it because I totally want to watch it because we missed it. Yeah. That was going to be one that we were going to see on opening night, actually, and we just missed it. Yeah, that was fun. I mean, it was described as Jaws, I think, in like sub-Saharan Africa. And I was like, I mean, sign me up.
Yeah.
Like, what are we talking about here? So I was in all the way. Great choice. Great pick.
It's awesome. Fun. It's fun. Just get some popcorn and watch it. It's not going to challenge you.
Yeah,
it's a
good,
you know, 90-minute watch. And I think that I'd love to see more movies like that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Can't wait to watch it. All right. So now I have back-to-back picks, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I have one that I'm confident about, and then we'll just go where it takes me. I'm going to go with Speak No Evil.
Damn it.
My fourth pick.
Yeah.
So I'm having anxiety, like just thinking about this movie. I don't know if you've seen it, Chris.
Which, by the way, is why I didn't see it, because everyone told me it will fuck you up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm stressed out enough. I got enough of my own anxiety. I don't need it. Like, I'll eventually see it. I will. My friends and I have it on our watch list. My friends and I have this thing where we have a watch list of like, we're going to do this. It's on there. I'll eventually see the movie. But yeah,
just prepare yourself.
I don't care if you spoil it. Go ahead.
I actually won't spoil it. I'm just going to like talk about the premise a little bit. But so we have a movie that focuses on a Danish family that visits a Dutch family that they met on holiday. And we have one couple that kind of represents this idea of feeling stuck in their lives, and another couple that we'll just say are more free spirited, I guess. And it's truly a horror of like social interaction.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, this visiting family, they keep being put in uncomfortable situations, but they don't want to say anything because they want to be polite. And it's just wild. It's an interesting look. Also, I'm excited to rewatch it at masculinity between these like two husbands and fathers. And I also need to rewatch it because I'm not totally clear on the, maybe not that movies make a clear argument, but just what it's trying to say, because I'm not totally sure I'm like on board with everything in it, but I need to rewatch it. Regardless, it is so effective as a thriller horror. People were not lying to you. Like, I feel anxiety just looking at the title. There's a scene in this I thought about for months, months.
There's two for me.
And just made me feel nauseous. It was gnarly.
You're not making me
want to
watch it. Yeah.
But so good.
When Zach came on, he said Saint Maud and this one are the most like kind of stuck in his mind for the past
few
years.
Didn't like the ending. I was cool with it. I think the reward of the movie is the social interactions throughout it. So
yeah, if you like Ruben Östlund's observations, the director writer of Triangle of Sadness and Force Majeure and other movies like that, if listeners like those kind of observations about how silly civilization can be and like rules, then this is the horror movie from you. Christian Taftrup, I believe, the Danish director. He makes a very unsettling movie. Kelsey described it perfectly. The ending is the most unsettling ending I've seen in years. And I don't know. This movie took like a divisive topic of finding the line between like well-intended honesty and insecurely offending people, and then took the tension of that cultural conversation that we're all having right now about being offended. And the movie has thoughts on that, like you said, I'm not sure like we necessarily agree with, but who really cares, because the horror about the movie is enough to go watch it. The first two acts specifically are a masterclass in how to deal with like human psychology in horror movies, and kind of seeing this family at a vacation home with another family and just like the dynamics between that and like what's okay and what's not okay. It kept me up for two or three nights. So Chris, I totally get like not watching this yet, especially because you have a
sometimes
lot more.
Sometimes at the end of the day, you want to decompress.
Yes.
You don't want to recompress. And throughout the whole day, I'm dealing with all kinds of stuff and, you know, being a dad and still in post pretty much every day. I'm on some kind of Zoom call about Shelby Oaks with the post production. Right. And so at the end of the day, I'm like, yeah, let's pop in a movie where I'm stressed the fuck out. It's not like my... it's not my purview at the time, but I will eventually check it out because enough people have recommended it to me.
Yeah. I would totally understand, just as a quick note to some listeners who, because I mean, Chris, I should have said it, and new listeners should know this too. Like, our podcast, The Extra Credits, is trying to find the extra credit or extra meaning of why movies deserve more recognition, usually in its themes. And that's what we usually bring to the end of every episode about a movie or show, is what deserves extra credit about this. It could be a camera angle, it could be a performance, it could be the score. And then we try to find a theme or the kind of intention of an author or the director or creative and try to understand what they're going for there. So that's why we always have been like intellectualizing all these movies. But if listeners have seen this movie and didn't like the third act, I totally understand it, because it does feel like a little culturally insensitive or tone deaf. And like, I totally get those things. And it's also because it might be a little foreign to us, because it is a Danish filmmaker making a movie that's not in the United States. And so there's a lot of kind of cultural differences there about opinions on these kind of social issues. So I am fascinated about listeners who haven't seen this, who go to see it. Let us know what you think. We're sorry that we put you through it if you signed up to watch it. But ultimately, it's a great movie for people who are interested in losing some sleep for a night or two, if you're interested in that kind of stuff. So
You're definitely right, Chris. Like, you can't go to bed after some of these, you know, you're so charged. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no
like
reason
looking
to do
in
it.
The corners of your room. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That was a great pick. What do you got next?
All right. Next, I was going to go with something that I drafted in the best of 2022 movies, which I knew was going to be something that maybe people had not seen. And so I just want to shout it out before I say my pick. All My Friends Hate Me on Hulu. Don't look at anything like the logline, I think, may give it away. It's marketed as a horror, but it's more of the like...
It's a British horror, so...
Yeah, psychological thriller. Okay, so yeah. Don't go in expecting whatever horror means or like the whatever you expect from a horror. Just go in, open-ended, All My Friends Hate Me. One of my favorite movies of the year and thrillers of the year.
It's also a great example just quickly of like how to do independent filmmaking. I mean, because that movie cost, we had Tom Sturton, the writer on, who's also the lead actor, and he talked about the process and it seemed grueling. So yeah. Chris, I can only imagine, but that movie cost like, I think it was $800,000 and it looks really, really good. So yeah, definitely recommend people to watch that. It was, I think, in both of our top 10s or top 15s for the year.
Another one about kind of like gathering social gathering anxieties, like protagonist complexes, class, privilege, guilt, like repressed emotions. It's so good.
Very millennial.
I'm not gonna pick it though because I already picked it in my top 20. Yes, definitely a millennial psychological horror.
Yeah,
but I picked it in my top 2022 movies of the year, so I'm gonna go with something else. Okay. I do think that technically, like the way a movie is shot, I do have it higher on my list, but I'm gonna go with this one because I really enjoyed myself. Fresh.
Nice.
You can also watch this on Hulu. I was really pleasantly surprised by this movie. Like, this movie could have gone wrong in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. where it would have been like too elevated or veered into something that didn't work. But I think it just turned out to be a really solid movie for me. Noah, our main character, played by Daisy Edgar Jones. Mm-hmm. And then she has this terrible time with like dating apps and just meeting people. And she meets Steve, played by Sebastian Stan, at a grocery store. And after their first date, you know, it seems too good to be true. And it is. Sebastian Stan is... Chris, have you seen this?
So, no.
Okay.
But I really, really want to. I do know... So I will say I know... So I'll be completely 100%
upfront. Because I don't want to spoil it.
No, listen, I've seen the first 40 minutes.
Okay.
I'm literally halfway through the movie. I paused it the other day, and it was just one of those things. I will finish it. It has one of my favorite title reveals I've ever seen.
I was just going to say the title drop is amazing.
Incredible.
Yeah. I will finish it, though. So, yeah, if you don't want to spoil the ending, I know everything for the first half.
But you know what Sebastian Stan's job is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yes. So then I'll say that. So Sebastian Stan is selling women for their body parts to eat to anonymous buyers or around the world and also their belongings. And I think the movie does a really good job of examining exploitation and objectification of women. There's a scene at the end where this isn't spoiling anything, but you really see like the magnitude of this organization that he's running. And I think it hits those themes really strong as well there. So I think that the ending actually didn't work for a lot of people. So Chris, I'm interested to see what you think about the ending,
sure.
But I really love this movie. Fresh is my final pick.
Nice.
Just the first half of the movie kind of inspired me, honestly. It made me start thinking about this other script idea I had that I wanted to write. And I kind of thought a lot about the movie Red Eye as well, mm-hmm. because there's a really, really strong, visceral reaction you can get from an audience when your movie starts as a romantic comedy and becomes horror, which is kind of what this movie feels like. And Red Eye as well. It's like this, you know, you meet a guy like you meet Cillian Murphy. He's got these startling blue eyes, and Rachel McAdams, and these two really beautiful people are just meeting, and it seems like it's going to work out. And then you're on the plane and it's terrible.
Yeah.
And I really love that as a setup. I think there's a lot to be mined from that.
Yeah, for sure. I think a little bit of that in Barbarian too, with the first 20 minutes of that movie too. Mimi Cave, again, another, I'm really surprised about all these like debut features for horror. I know it's a horror moment right now, which is like perfect timing for Shelley Oaks.
It's an incredible moment for first time filmmakers. I mean, it's just what's going on with horror right now is so inspirational. And just from my perspective of talking to people, after making the film finally and what the industry is hungry for, you're going to see a lot of amazing horror in the next few years. And last year was a great year for horror. I think one of the best ever. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see a lot more of that soon.
Yeah, which is nice because even though we had like, Chris, like we're around the same age, like even though we had like nice horrors like in the 2000s, like there's only so much Saw and Final Destination you can get without being like, all right, when are we going to get like the good stuff. There's almost so much like horror IP they can pick from. So all these original stories.
We're also,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, please.
No, okay. I was just going to say all these original stories are, you're right, very inspirational. Even just like we don't make movies, but like just doing what we do creatively, it is like nice to see people really go for it. And all around the same age too, like we're 28. So the idea that people around like 30 are all kind of doing the same thing, which is like, I'm going to go, it is very millennial. It's like, I'm going to go to this career that I've always wanted to do. I'm going to really fully invest all my time in this. I'm just going to do it. It is so awesome to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and we're also finally getting to a point, not to get too far away from Fresh, but like we're finally getting to a point where Hollywood is starting to embrace the sort of mid-budget horror again. Like Black Phone was $18 million, and that's a strange number, you know. It's like, it's not like you're used to this Blumhouse model of like make your movie for $5 million or $4 million, like Barbarian I think was four. But like you're starting to see them embrace that sort of like, we're making a movie for theaters, this is a larger film, you can do more stuff with it again, like you could in the 2000s and in the 90s where people were just throwing money at these really interesting original concepts. But you're still getting these great like indie movies like the one you just mentioned, which 800,000. And it's just a really, really great time for genre filmmaking.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of title card drops, I do think this is like in the top three of the year. Like you're totally like, you guys are right. Like I was thinking of After Yang, Koganata's film probably number one with the whole dancing sequence and the title card sequence. I didn't see that coming from a mile away. And then I'm a big Chazelle head. So Babylon was huge for me and just like her whisk score like booming roar through the theater. So those are like in my top three. So I loved that. And also Mimi Cave, just his last shout out on Fresh, the director, writer of Fresh, she's going to be making a movie called a thriller, Holland, Michigan, and that's going to be starring Nicole Kidman and Matthew McFadden from Succession.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, okay. So it's a big, big year for our guy, McFadden, and I think that's how you pronounce it, McFadden. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. I apologize. But that'll be coming from Amazon. I'm really excited for that. So great pick.
He has to have something to do after Succession, you know?
Yes, that's true.
Tom leaving us.
Okay, so Chris, you're up with your last and final pick.
Okay, so this is weird. I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's also more of a thriller than a horror, I will say. But, you know, that's fine. This is also a Hulu movie, and it's called No Exit.
Yes.
So did you guys see this or not?
I saw it. Traded. I'm so excited that you picked this. It was on my list, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So No Exit, again, similar to Beast, is the type of movie that I just don't see enough of. And it may be because they're harder to find these types of contained stories that are very built around suspense, because so many of them have been done. But I think about movies like Breakdown with Kurt Russell, or Cellular with Chris Evans, or of course Red Eye, or Panic Room, or Out of Time with Denzel Washington. These movies that are like about like a tense scenario, and you feel like every move the character makes, they're gonna die. Mm-hmm. Like every choice could result in death. And it's so exciting when a good one comes along. And I'll just read the log line of No Exit for like those who haven't seen it. During a blizzard and stranded at an isolated highway rest stop in the mountains, a college student discovers a kidnapped child hidden in a car belonging to one of the people inside.
It's great.
So basically, like, you got unknowns, strangers that are stranded at this place, and they're all just waiting for this blizzard to go over. When the one right person notices that one of them has probably kidnapped this kid, you spend the whole movie wondering who did it, which one is it, and will she survive this night? But there's also a lot of good stuff about like her character is a recovering addict, and she's maybe fleeing from the rehab facility, and so it kind of explores that a bit with her and people thinking maybe she's crazy, maybe she's not, maybe she's imagining this, maybe it's all in her head, or, you know, and it does fun things with the characters while also being tense the whole way through. And that's a real soft spot for me. I really love movies like that. And I think they're also far more challenging to make than people often describe them as. The word simple is thrown around a lot with movies like the ones I mentioned, but they're insanely difficult to write because you have to find ways to keep your protagonist on the hook for 80 minutes to 100 minutes. And they never can escape. Otherwise the tension goes away. And how can you pull that off realistically? How can you give your protagonist enough victories and enough defeats to keep them interesting, but also make the audience root for the character. Mm-hmm. They're very difficult to craft and pull off because there's also a billion of them. There's a million of these types of movies where there's like one thing and there's a tense, like we talked about Watcher, which is a more mature exploration of sort of a quote unquote simple idea. But movies like that, I want more of them. And I thought No Exit was very overlooked.
Yeah, I love when a movie can speak to all audiences, and there's nothing speaking to all audiences more than trying to survive. And that is like what this movie is about. I watched it as like a random thing I threw on a Sunday. I wasn't really planning to watch it. It was just something that came across my screen on Hulu, which I guess is the kind of best, the poison pill you have to swallow with these streaming services is that sometimes they will support some of these independent films, which is amazing. And Damien Power, I think, is the director on this, and it's his first film, I believe.
Yeah.
And this movie just really surprised me. I'm so glad you took it. It felt like, and I mean this as a compliment, it felt like it was a collection of scenes where a gamer of like a horror video game can make a decision. And like you as the audience feel like, would I
like quick time events?
Yes, exactly. And you're like, would I do this? Would I do that? And as soon as the character is doing what they're doing and she's making her decisions, you're like, okay, I probably would have done that too. And then whatever comes. And I just really love that about it, especially putting you in this very specific predicament that seems realistic enough about being stuck somewhere with a bunch of people you don't know, which we have seen done before, especially in like Blizzard-esque movies that kind of put you in like winter. But this one felt really clever in how it ends up finishing. Also, the final scene, I felt like it was taken from a high budget horror movie. There's a really nice conclusion. It's really well made and well crafted. And I want to rewatch it. I'm just trying to gather my thoughts on it. But yeah, it's a great movie.
And like, you know, it also has Dennis Haysbert, and Dennis Haysbert's incredible. He I remember the first time I noticed him, I think was in Far From Heaven with Julianne Moore, but then he kind of just did a lot of insurance commercials for many years. And so I was really happy to see him and his like powerful, amazing voice in this movie too. And Dale Dickey, who's like an icon of these types of movies and a great character actress. So if you guys haven't seen No Exit, who are your listeners, I would check it out. It's worth your time.
Yeah, it feels like it would have done a killing on Shudder. Maybe it was there, but it seems like one of those Shudder movies that would do very well with horror fans. Okay, last pick of the draft.
I'm so interested in what you're going to pick.
We've all done very well here. I'm going to end with a pick that is, I think, the most underrated horror movie this year. Of course, I'm the one saying that. But this movie is called Master. It is on Amazon Prime. I wish we could have all seen this in the theater. Unfortunately, I don't think it came to theaters. It is directed by Marima Diallo. And I think if marketed correctly, this would have done numbers at the box office. And I think if people are interested, listeners, in Jordan Peele's Us or Julius Ona's Loose, which came out a couple years ago, which was another underseen thriller that was very good. Mm-hmm. Master is the movie for you to enjoy on first viewing. And then if you want to take your friends and pick it apart on second viewing, there is a lot here. I shouted him out before, but there's a great critic by the name of Robert Daniels who did a really great exploration of this movie on IndieWire that I'll share in the description. There are really thoughtful ideas in this movie about cultural segregation, and the movie follows Regina Hall to do those things, and she gives one of her best performances in years. She is a college professor at a university that has a very wealthy white populace, and they are, how do I put it, I guess, openly exploiting Black culture or what they perceive as Black culture. And without spoiling the horror aspects of this film, the movie takes a chance by not focusing on explicit racism as the horror, which you think is going to happen, but instead it focuses on the terror of microaggressions and all forms of like subtle racism or colorism. So the script is really fascinating from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited for listeners to check it out and see what they think. Chris, I think you'd like it because it has supernatural elements that I don't want to step on, but if you haven't seen it, I recommend checking it out because it does have that.
I just added it to my watch list.
Amazing. Yeah, it is definitely something that I think is going to inspire a lot of people. I've been using that word a lot, but these horror movies, like we said, have been like super influential, and they will be for a while. I almost forgot. There is a sequence in this movie where, I don't know if every listener will be familiar with this, but a Sheck West song plays, and it plays at a party, and that specific party scene, when the song pops off, is turns into like a grounded horror that I fully bought into and invested in.
Yeah.
And it is very rare for a movie that is playing with supernatural elements to ever get that grounded feeling back from the audience. And I felt myself like I felt myself being played with by like a director who knows what they're doing. Like Mariano Diallo is like really great at putting you in these like tense situations, taking you to the abstract, and then putting you back into the anxiety-inducing box that she's created for you. And I highly recommend this movie. People who have seen Master probably know what I'm talking about, but it is like really underseen and like not heavily reviewed on Letterboxd. So I hope more people go and see it.
Yeah.
Okay, we did it, guys. We did it. So Let me read these out to the listeners so they know who they're going to be voting for. We'll have a nice image out on social media when this drops so people will see it. So, Kelsey, you drafted Nope, Watcher, Nanny, Speak No Evil, and Fresh. Chris, you got Pearl, The Menu, The Black Phone, Beast, and No Exit. And then I took Barbarian, Men, Bones and All, Bodies, 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 and Master. Great list, y'all. We did a good job.
Yeah, what a great year. Oh, my God. Yeah.
I hope this is just like the next
few
years.
Truly incredible year for horror.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about what's going on in horror right now. Also, this podcast was super fun. Thank you for asking me to come on.
Yeah, of course. Sorry we're keeping you so late. I didn't expect it to go this long.
Oh, no. It was great. It was fun. I mean, this was a blast.
Is there any honorable mentions you guys want to throw out before we head out of here? Because I really only had to just bring up like two. I wanted to bring up Smile. Mm-hmm. I usually dislike movies that are there to jump scare me. And I think it's not cool to call horror movies or reduce them as like roller coasters. But this movie by Parker Finn made me, I was going to say smile, but again, the puns are not
I think
good
this is the first movie that I screamed out loud in the theater at, and not that I'm above
you
people
shouted.
Who also scream in the movie, you know. I just normally don't do that. Like I'm not as vulnerable, you know, as the people who are screaming out loud. And maybe I'm not as comfortable in the theater. But I forget even if it was the jump scare, but I don't know. I remember screaming. I was so embarrassed, but Smile was a lot of fun.
Yeah, ton of fun. Parker Finn is gonna do a lot of big things, and that movie was surprisingly really commercial. I think it made next to Black Phone the most money in horror this year. So
it made a lot of money. Yeah. It's, but in regards to like things people are talking about, like in industry, you know, meetings and stuff, it's always, is it Smile or Barbarian? those names get thrown around a lot.
Yeah, I bet. And then the last one I just want to shout out was, The Eternal Daughter, I'll just say. I don't know if that counts as a horror movie, Joanna Hogg's ghost story, but I recommend people check that out. If you don't have a TV that does well with blacks, it's going to be a struggle like it was for us.
Like us, yeah.
If you have an OLED or anything like that, definitely check that out. And then Scream. We're going to be talking a lot about Scream this week, but Scream from this year, it's kind of like the whole Ty West thing where we're getting two movies from the same franchise within like 10-12 months of each other, so that's kind of nice and weird. But Scream, probably the worst title in years, because it should be called Scream 5. I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing now, though. Candyman, Halloween, Scream, they're all doing it.
It's tough.
It's like, come on, how am I supposed to talk about these movies? No one will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I already thought
about
it.
We're all just going to create our own titles for it anyway. We're just going to say, you know, 2007 Halloween or 2018 Halloween,
right.
Or
yeah,
you know, 2022 Candyman or whatever. You know, we're all just, that's what we're gonna say, so might as well just make it different.
I've been trying to prep for Scream 1996 this week, and I keep searching on pods like Scream, and I just keep clicking 2022 reviews. So I think probably a lot of people are having that issue. I think what works this movie is that it's like obviously the meta narrative from Scream, but it's like meta. It's like self-referential to a funny degree, and so it is a lot of fun. This movie's a lot of fun. I don't want to spoil it. Kelsey hasn't seen it yet. But yeah, those are my honorable mentions. Do you have any others, Kels?
Yeah, I only have one that you didn't talk about, which is Resurrection.
Oh yeah.
What streaming did we watch this on? Shudder?
That is on Amazon through Shudder.
Gotcha. Yeah, a really great movie. That I think is a psychological horror, like a dark mystery. And really looks at the idea of like stigma and abuse, and a woman trying to just keep her and her daughter safe. And I thought it was really effective. There were some parts I get really squeamish with horror movies, especially like body gore stuff. So, but there was a metaphor in this movie. They really like went all the way with
it. Stuck to it.
Yeah. And I respected it. And Resurrection's a really great watch. I was in it the whole time.
Rebecca Hall is just, oh my God, she's so good in it.
Yeah.
And so is Tim Roth. Because, I mean, he had a really challenging performance in that you kind of like, you're supposed to hate him, but also somehow believe him. And he's saying the most absurd things right. that like make no sense. I mean, no sense at all. And but he sells it all. And those performers, my God. I guess mine is I would by no means call this underrated. Everyone's seen it, but we didn't mention Prey. And I think Dan Trachtenberg did a really phenomenal job with Prey. A very unique idea for a Predator movie, and that it's sort of goes away from everything we're expecting a Predator movie to be, but also kind of takes it back to basics and is able to explore a bunch of people from the Comanche Nation who are like seeing something that they don't understand and trying to fight against it. And I think that's a really fun way into a new Predator movie. Mm-hmm. Also, one of the most like banger action sequences Sick. Where, you know, when he's taking out all the dudes in that sort of like misty forest, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
That was a really fun time. Also a Hulu movie.
Yeah. I got excited for that because Alien is going to come out with, I mean, Alien's my favorite movie of all time. Yeah. By Ridley Scott. And
Alien by Ridley Scott.
If you haven't heard of it. there's going to be, I think Alvarez is doing it from Don't Breathe, which is another underrated horror. Yep, so, and he's going to be doing an adaptation of Alien that I'm hyped for. It's going to be coming out on Hulu. So shout out Hulu, giving horror fans what they want. Two other things, haven't seen.
And Hellraiser as well.
Hellraiser, mm-hmm. Yes. Actually didn't catch that. But yeah, they're doing a great job of kind of creating, getting new IP from older stuff. So two movies I haven't seen, just want to shout out, and then we'll head out. Mad God and We're All Going to the World's Fair. I've gotten a lot of people saying to watch those two movies. We didn't get the chance to watch those, but I'm sure they would have come closer, if not on our list, if we would have seen them. So still got to check those out.
You should see All the World's Fair just for the ASMR sequence.
Okay.
I did see it. I was pretty, I won't say anything about it, but I was amazed that a movie actually got away with doing an entire ASMR scene. It was pretty cool.
That reminds me of a movie getting away in Smile with doing like an audio scene of looking like at a podcast audio almost and like listening back and then a jump scare happening on
Trey
the side.
Trey is someone, I don't know if you do this, Chris, but he closes his eyes and when he's watching these,
I do.
These
I do
scenes,
the one
like,
eye
yeah,
close.
The total, yeah, yeah. Like watch the movie. Yeah,
it's a problem.
But yeah, I think the last one and then we're good. I think I just want to make sure so people aren't like, they didn't mention this. Crimes of the Future.
Oh yeah.
I think the body gore was interesting. Ultimately, it didn't like fully work for me, but I totally understand as far as the themes, why it really worked for some people. And I still thought it was a really interesting movie with these ideas of a futuristic world and art and this existential idea of like finding meaning. And so Crimes of the Future is a good watch too.
Okay, very nice. All right, everyone, check the description of our podcast to find our social media where you can vote for your favorite list. And remember to check our show description to follow Chris on his YouTube channel, his podcast, which I'm sure most people already follow the channel, but definitely follow the podcast. Mm-hmm. And then support his movie, Shelby Oaks, which again, we're going to be covering on this show hopefully sometime soon. And then Chris, thanks again for coming on and being
a
real
so
inspiration in the film community. And thank you.
Well, thank you guys. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much. Rickety-dickety, Mongoose is gone. Won't be coming around for Tequila Snake no more, my love. Rickety-dickety, Mongoose is gone. Everybody who read the Jungle Book and know the Rickety-dickety is a mongoose who kills snakes. When I was a young man, I was led to believe there were organizations to kill my snakes for me. I.e. the church, i.e. the government, i.e. school. But when I got a little older, I learned how to kill them.